Good afternoon. I'd like to call to order the House Interim Committee on Energy, Environment, and Water, which I think we all know we call EW for short.
EW.
And I'm glad you're here. I'm glad for those that are listening elsewhere. And we're pleased to start this meeting with a little bit of organizational business. Then we will follow the agenda as you have it in front of you, or I don't see any copies back there, but that are made available to you on the table. So no changes there. Colleagues, we're waiting for two of our colleagues, and
the usual suspects.
Hopefully they'll be here in the next few seconds so we can adopt these, what is pretty standard fare, which is our the rules for interim committees. You all probably have that in front of you. There are a few minor changes, and I, first of all, we're very glad that we have a veteran as our administrator in Beth Petrino, so we're glad you're here, Beth.
Thank you.
And my first request is if you would highlight any of the changes that maybe may or may not be interested in.
Sure.
Before we adopt them.
I'll be happy
to. Here's Representative Thompson now.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, these changes that I'm going to describe are to the last set of interim rules because there are a number of changes between session rules and interim rules. But the first one is one rule was removed, which just identified the co-chairs as officers of the committee. I'm not actually sure what effect that rule had anyway. So it's been removed. And then four rules have been added. One establishes the co-chairs are ex officio voting members of all subcommittees. Another requires that notice of meetings include a specification of what type of meeting will be held. Number nine authorizes the presiding chair to limit public testimony in order to accommodate the greatest number of witnesses. Number 10 establishes that any member of the committee may attend a subcommittee meeting to which they are not assigned but may not vote or be counted for the purposes of quorum. And then in rule number 11, the number of members that are required to request a roll call vote has been changed from 1 to 2.
Now, when you say 11,
yes,
I don't think I have 11.
In the back, perhaps? You don't.
Very interesting.
I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Is everyone else?
There it is.
They do. Oh, you have two pages.
Sorry, Ben Cannon used to do this to me all the time.
you have to turn it over, actually.
Okay, again, Representative, mine's blank.
Good stuff.
Oh, sorry. That's what I'm
saying. So, before I request, I was going to do this after, but I'm going to do it now. Before I request the fact that I'm open for a motion. I want to, before he makes his first official act as my new co-chair, I want to welcome my new co-chair, Representative Bailey. Many of you may have read in the paper that a terrible scandal and Representative Cannon had to leave the country. He heretofore will be known as Representative Big Shot because he's now working with the governor as his education policy advisor. I think that's a wise choice by the governor, but as usual, I was not consulted. And we're going to miss him, and I enjoyed working with him. I enjoy this committee very much, and I am particularly pleased that Representative Bailey has stepped up to be my new co-chair, and I just want to make sure that you know you are welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Looking forward to being in this role and working with all of you. And I think one of the themes that we've seen in this committee has been around efficiency, around reducing packaging, around recycling. So just think of me as the old co-chair, just less packaging.
more efficient, smaller, more compact.
So looking forward to this. Are you looking for a motion also?
No, I'm not. I'm looking for something from Representative Boone.
Well, and I have to say, there's one other thing that Representative Bailey can offer in this committee, and those of you in the audience will really appreciate this, but you need to go get your Rosetta Stone programs out, because all meetings from now on that he chairs will be done in Chinese.
Boy, after 2 weeks in China, I look forward to that. So, now I am open to a motion.
Chair Gilliam, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated 9-21-11.
Representative and co-chair Bailey moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated 9-21-11. Colleagues, any discussion on the rules? Seeing none, I'm going to ask our clerk to call the roll.
Representative Bench.
Aye.
Representative Thompson.
Aye.
Representative Witt.
Excused.
Co-Vice Chair Boone.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Co-Chair Bailey.
Aye.
Co-Chair Gilliam.
Aye. So the motion passes, and these rules are adopted. So that's out of the way, and I would like to open up an informational meeting. And our first subject is going to be on integrated water resources strategy. We're going to get an update from the department, and I am pleased to have our friend Brenda Bateman come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. It's good to be back again. For the record, my name is Brenda Bateman with the Oregon Water Resources Department. And we are currently in mid-stride developing the Integrated Water Resources Strategy. So I'm not bringing you finality today, but I am bringing you just a few brief process and content updates that we wanted to share with you. Just as a brief reminder, this project has its origins in House Bill 3369 from the 2009 session, where the legislature directed WRD to serve really as a project manager, as a lead partner in efforts to develop a strategy that would help us both understand and meet Oregon's water needs. And because this is not your traditional water supply strategy, that is, it's broader than that, we talk about it in an integrated way, looking at water quantity, water quality, and meeting our ecological needs. And because of that, we need to partner, of course, with our sister agencies at the state level, but also local and federal level, tribes, other stakeholders, and the public as well. One of the things the legislature asked us to do as part of this was to account for coming pressures, such as changes in climate, changes in population and land use as well. So one of the first things that we've done is put together some background information. I'll not go through all of this here because that's background information you've already seen before, but just wanted to remind you there's a whole gallery of maps that we have up on our project website, and the challenges that we've identified both for today and tomorrow when it comes to Oregon's water is across the board. We're having challenges now with regard to water quality and supply and fish habitat and habitat access. There are many things that need to be addressed today, as well as looking into the future. So these are some of the reasons that are put forward and that are in more detail up on our website. Where are we today? Just past the halfway point. We're actually aiming for adoption of the formal strategy by the Water Resources Commission by the end of 2012, and yet that'll be just the beginning. From there, we'll be launching into budget recommendations, policy recommendations, and bringing all of those into the Oregon Legislature for the 2013 session. So we're right in the middle of a timeline here, and I wanted to give you just a couple of high points from the phases we've moved through already. Phase one, as I mentioned, was spent putting together a lot of our materials, sketching out the problem statement. Why should Oregon be doing some long-term planning? And while we were doing that, we were also very carefully gathering around us some advisory groups that we know we're going to need to check our work and also to help us with implementation when it comes time. We have an 18-member citizen advisory group, 17-member state agency advisory group, and a 10-member federal liaison group, and these have all been great advisors to us, both politically and technically, as we move through this project. In phase two, we got down a little bit further into the meat of the matter. We asked folks to help us identify what are the critical water-related issues that are facing your communities now. And as you know, communities can be defined in different ways. So we went to stakeholder meetings of industry and member associations. We met with the tribes. And then we also went around the state so that we were in diverse geographical locations. We had 11 face-to-face open houses and also asked these same questions and asked for input electronically online. This was to help us sketch out what the critical issues were that we were to address. So we're in phase three right now, and I would draw your attention to what we're affectionately calling the place map. Poster size for your rooms if you're so inclined. But this piece of paper is really just an at-a-glance tool that we're using to show how all of the pieces are starting to come together. So you have hard copy in front of you, and these materials are also available through the department. But just so you're a little oriented there, the dark blue lines or the dark blue rows that are running across the page spell out the objectives, and these came to us through House Bill 3369. This is where it asks us to pinpoint, to understand and to meet Oregon's water needs. The critical issues, as I mentioned before, were gathered, honed, and pared down through some of our outreach efforts last year. And now we're in a phase of actually developing recommended actions. So this is where the rubber hits the road, and I wanted to just give you a quick orientation to the 12 issue areas that are emerging through this process. In the top row there, you will see numbered actions 1 through 3 that really focus heavily on data. We know that we need more data that would be helpful in our long-term planning. And so what you'll see here are requests for data, both to better understand the physical water resource, as well as to understand our in-stream and our out-of-stream needs. In the lower right-hand quadrant of this paper, you'll also see we've developed a little bit more detail this idea of the coming pressures. So this is where you'll find issues like climate change and land use change. And then we added a couple as well. We talk more and more about that water-energy nexus, and so that's found in this area, as well as water-related infrastructure, both the need for new infrastructure as well as maintenance and rehabilitation of the infrastructure we have. And then finally, in the last quadrant of this page, you'll see probably the traditional types of projects that one would expect to see in a state water supply plan. So this is where you'll find topics like water storage and water reuse, conservation and efficiency, restoration, and other project-oriented areas. There are 12 of these items. Again, this is an at-a-glance page that's in front of you. There's much more detail and background on each of these topics on our website. So we wanted to let you know that this is not the end of it. There's much more detail to be had. But if you're looking for your favorite issue, or you want to make sure that we've considered the right water-related issues for the next several years, here's where you might look first to see where that issue resides. I think I might pause there for a moment. I do have a calendar of events, upcoming next steps, but wondered if you have any clarifying questions or topic-related questions on this page.
Any questions from members at this stage? None. Feel free.
This summer, we took public comment on these 12 issue items and the detail that's behind them. We received some very thoughtful comments, about 50 in all, from both individual members of the public and from organizations that we had not yet heard from as part of this process. So we were very happy to have that input, and we're sifting through all of that now. What you'll see next from us is a draft that brings together all of these little pieces and the detail that we've just sort of touched on here briefly. We hope to have a draft strategy out for public review by the end of this calendar year. And we'll then take that next spring. You may remember from the legislation, our Water Resources Commission is required to notify and consult with other boards and commissions before they adopt anything. So they'll be vetting this with their counterparts, their colleagues on other boards and commissions, and we'll have that conversation next spring. They are aiming for adoption of the strategy during their August meeting next summer, and then we'll really be filling in a lot more of the details, dollar figures, staffing numbers, work plans and timelines as we bring you materials in 2013 to implement these ideas. As you recall, the legislation asks us to update every 5 years, so there will be an opportunity for adaptive management and for some evolution of the details. We wanted to let folks know that we continue to take public input. We welcome it. And so there are many ways that you can get in touch with this project through our website and through our email addresses if you have continued concerns or ideas that we should be folding into the project. And with that, I'd be happy to take any questions from the committee.
Brenda, I think you said you're looking at, and you've noted the policy and rulemaking areas, the likely areas. You said for the next legislative session, so we probably won't see policy recommendations for February.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. Yes.
If there are no other questions, Representative Betts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Brenda, where in this do I, would I find the part of our strategy that will protect Oregon's water from other people taking it? Where's that protection piece?
Mr. Chair and Representative, the protection piece is something that's going to be in the broader strategy. So we have put together as part of our materials assurances about what this project is and what it is not. And as we've said before in front of this committee, and thank you for bringing that up because it's an ongoing theme that we need to make sure we've conveyed. The forward planning is not about undoing or jeopardizing the water rights that folks hold today. We want to be very clear about this. We want folks to take stock of what they have today and look forward into the future, anticipate and try to adapt to some of the changes that may be coming. But we have those assurances in there, and we'll continue to stand by those, that this is not meant to undo or jeopardize those assets and water rights that are being held today. Now, the recommendations that are on this at-a-glance page tend to be more of the changes that we are proposing, and so you're not likely to find that particular language on this sheet.
Follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Given the importance of water for our economy, it seems to me that that would have a major part in our strategy. Because without water, we're not going to be creating the jobs and doing all of the things that we need to have the economy we have to have for all the obvious reasons. So that part should be really clear from this document. But I'm sure if I work my way through it, I'd find something that gets me there. But I would like it to be much more clear than what I see here.
Yes.
Now, there's two pieces to this. I wasn't really talking so much about water rights, but I was going to ask, I was going to get there. I was actually talking about the water grab that's going to occur under the Clean Water Act and the water grab that may occur from neighboring states or the water grab that may occur from upstream users. Where is that? Where is the element here of this state aggressively defending that which it now thinks it has? Where is that piece?
Mr. Chair, Representative, you'll find that idea embedded in what's item number 10 here. So this is place-based approaches, and in that piece we have a placeholder for transboundary negotiations and discussions of the type that I think you're referring to. And so again, you won't see that text laid out in detail here, but we are very aware that those discussions are taking place and may be looming, and that's something that we have accounted for.
One follow-up.
Please.
As you know from our past many discussions, there's nothing more important to this state than its water. Nothing. And this document is a great reflection of kind of an interior look, kind of an inward introspective study of how we manage what we think we've got. That, to me, we need to be, since I live immediately adjacent to a state that's extremely worried about its water, that would be Idaho, and another one extremely worried about its water, that would be Nevada, and another extremely worried about Montana, and also Washington. Those folks are not in it for Oregon. And so we have to be in it for ourselves, and I need to see a much more aggressive posture in these kinds of documents, not to the extent that we're trying to take what they have, but certainly to the extent of protecting what we think we have. And so I would ask that be not buried somewhere in the 10th or 11th part of this document. I would like to see it right at the front. That's my thought on it.
Mr. Chair, Representative, point well taken.
Thanks.
Thank you, Representative. Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Brenda, this is a pretty remarkable document. There's a lot to absorb here all at once, and I'm sure that as we each have a chance to dive into it more deeply, we'll have other comments. Just a quick scattershot of things that are comments, actually. It is not in your bottom left-hand box around understanding the coming pressures that affect our needs and supplies. I'm not sure it fits in any one of these boxes, but it seems to be around the nexus issues that you talk about here. Maybe I'm missing it, but I don't see a specific call out for the nexus between water and economic development. And I think about that not only in a agricultural context or an energy context, but also as an input to manufacturing and as an input to a lot of the different businesses that we have that rely on clean water and on adequate water. So I'd like to see that called out. Also under the climate change bullet here, you talk a little bit about adaptation strategies with regards to water, climate change. Perhaps this is splitting hairs on a semantic point, but I'd also like to see a consideration of resiliency strategies with climate change in our water supply. And I see adaptation and resiliency as related, but distinct. Adaptation, I think, implies some change, whereas resiliency is how do we best preserve what we have and continue to be able to have an adequate and clean water supply in the face of changes.
Mr. Chair, Representative, just a brief response to that, and both points are correct. Economic development piece of it, you'll see more in the top right quadrant, which is getting a better handle on our actual needs. And one of the struggles that we've had is forecasting, particularly in the area of economic development. For example, how do you survey companies that have not yet arrived here as to their water needs? So there's a little bit of difficulty there, and we've actually posed this question in a couple of other fora that we've been part of, if folks have a good methodology or something that they would suggest that we use as part of that, that would be very helpful. Of course, we're also talking to companies who would like to expand, and those are easier to identify and contact, but it's maybe the not yet arrived that poses a challenge when it comes to forecasting and long-term demand. As to the climate change, I think your point's right on. I think that term is probably missing, the resiliency term.
Other comments or questions on the report? Seeing none, does that complete yours, Brenda?
Mr. Chair.
Then thank you for coming,
and thank you very much.
We'll move to the next subject. Continuing with our informational meeting, I'd like to ask Palmer Mason to come up from the Department of Environmental Quality and give us an update on the paint stewardship program.
Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Palmer Mason. I'm with the Department of Environmental Quality. I was asked to come and talk about the Oregon Paint Product Stewardship Program, and specifically I was asked to talk about why the department is asking for an extension to our legislative report. Under the legislation that passed in 2009, DEQ was to submit a report to the legislature by October the 1st. The reason why we're asking for more time to submit that report to you is quite honestly to have more time to look at the annual report that was given to us and allow more time for public debate and comment over that report and the draft recommendations that DEQ is going to submit. The 09 legislation required the stewardship organization that's managing the paint and actually also managing the funds that are used to provide for the collection and recycling and disposal of the paint, their annual report was to be submitted to us as of September the 1st. And it was only 30 days later that we were asked to send the legislative report to the legislature. And it didn't seem to us that a month was sufficient amount of time to look at that report, evaluate it, allow the stakeholders to evaluate it, develop draft recommendations, allow for a public comment period around those draft recommendations, and submit a final finished product to the legislature. So what we did is we talked to the co-chairs of the House and Senate Environmental Committees and asked for an extension. And my understanding is they thought that that was acceptable, but they did ask that I come to the committee today and explain why we are doing that. So that's the process that we have followed, is to make, check in with the legislature, check in with the committees to see that that was appropriate, and you know, it seemed to be in order to get a more robust public process around those recommendations. And our goal is to submit the report to the legislature in final form by November the 15th. We'd asked for an extension to December the 1st, but we're going to try and send that report in early because that's the next set of legislative days, and if the committee is so inclined, it's an opportunity to talk about the full report the next time the committee holds a meeting. I can take any questions the committee may have.
Mr. Co-Chair, I assume this predates you, so I haven't talked to Ben about this specifically. I think the conversations were probably separate. You colleagues, help me. I don't really know what our authority, I mean, clearly we can be cooperative. I don't know what our authority is to grant such an extension. Anybody have input on that?
We could make a recommendation. My question was, and I'm really timely that you're here today, because I received a message from a constituent, and that was one of his complaints, among others, about the Builders Board requirements for builders and contractors. And one of his complaints, and I'm not sure whether he was discussing this program or the overall stuff that they're asked to do, but he said there's no oversight and there's no impetus for people to follow the law. And are you having good compliance rates? Do you have that, or is that still not into the report?
Right. Co-chairs and Representative Boone, that's something we're still evaluating, but I do know that stakeholders have brought up maybe related issues in that, for instance, a customer will go into the store and the brochures and signage may not necessarily be there at that individual store to let them know that if I buy paint, I have unused paint, that I have a place to take it back. Mm-hmm. So that has been an issue. In some places, another issue that we have heard is whether we have ramped up to the point where there are enough convenient collection opportunities for people bringing back paint. I mean, at the end of the day, the consumer is paying for this program, and there ought to be a convenient site as much as we can make it near where they are. So those have been some of the issues. One thing I do need to say, this is a pilot project. It was the first in the country. So the stewardship organization that's running this has been ramping up, trying to put all the infrastructure in place. They have worked aggressively, but there have been concerns from both the EQ and the stakeholders. Are we getting everything that we need in place? And so I could see that someone would ask, you know, is DEQ exercising enough oversight? I feel like we have, but I also will tell the committee this report will be very important in terms of outlining what really needs to be a part of a permanent program, if that's the legislature's desire to make this program permanent, is what would it include? Do we have enough collection sites? Are they managed in a way that is safe and environmentally and effective in terms of cost? Because we don't want the cost to be exorbitant for this. Those kind of questions will all really come up in the review of this report.
And follow up?
No, please.
I just wonder, maybe this person was mixing this up with the lead paint thing. There could be that too. I'll follow up on that myself and to find out.
Thank you for those comments. And I would at this point just add that if what we're saying here is just from an administrative standpoint, you just need a little more time to put the. I personally, and I'd be interested in your input, committee. I'm okay with that, and I'm particularly okay with it because of what Palmer just said. This is a pilot project. I want to know how it's going. We all want it to work, but we want to keep our eye on what a permanent kind of program or direction we want to take for the next session as a committee. So probably want to avoid getting into the details when he hasn't had a chance to actually do the report yet. To the extent of my unbelievably far-reaching power and authority in this building, I'm okay with the extension, partly because of what I just said, and partly because I know the department has worked very hard to get this thing to the point we are. I know it has not been easy, and I know that you're working on that. I know it's one of the priorities. So with that comment, I welcome any other comments, Representative Benz, but we may want to move on as soon as we can.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Palmer, I appreciate all your hard work on this, and I appreciated your work in trying to put together an appropriate means of explaining to the committee in this report how much the organization that's busy doing the work and collecting the money is being paid for what it's doing. And one of the reasons I would join the co-chair in saying take the time you need is to make sure that you are able to tell us how much the program is costing and how much those who are helping implement the program are being paid for so doing, so that we aren't blamed for creating some sort of monopoly that channels a whole bunch of money to the folks that are now putting this new program in place. That would be bad news. And I know you are aware of that, and so I'm looking forward to seeing the report address it. I know as carefully as you have to, this monopolistic situation that enjoys a fee that we've put in place. So am I correct in understanding that you will be trying to address that issue in this report when we see it?
Co-chairs and Representative Vance, the answer is yes, we will be. And I know you and I have talked extensively about that issue. And so that's one that is high on our list to look at, is make sure that it's not just the oversight in terms of collection and the management and the convenience, but also in terms of the financial side. I know that's a very important issue to you, and it's also an important issue to us. And if this is to be a national model, I think our look is even all that more critical. There are other states that have adopted similar programs, Connecticut and California, and they're looking at us as we work through these issues. So I've got to believe that legislators in those states feel the same way. So yes, that's an important issue, and we will be looking at it.
Thank you.
Other comments? Seeing none, I would say, committee, we've got two more of these committee days before the February session, January and
November
and January. And if I understood you right, you'd try to get to us by the November one, or
that is correct.
January, so
that,
November.
Right.
And I think we can look forward to putting that on our calendar. So we thank you for coming today, and we'll look forward to the report.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, colleagues, let's move on, and you'll see on your agenda that the Energy Incentives Program Implementation Overview, the first of a couple of three subjects from the department. So if Anthony Buckley's here, we are ready for your report. And while you're being seated, we just want to welcome Representative Witt. Good to see you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Did you notice there's a new co-chair?
I did.
Ollie.
Yeah.
Pretty good, huh?
Now, does he believe that there are other kinds of energy that's sources that are available, hydrogen or anything like that?
Representative, thank you for bringing that up. We're going to clear the calendar and just talk a little bit about that today.
What is this hydrogen you speak of? Co-chair, I haven't...
Oh, I've trained him well. Okay. Well,
Co-chair Gillum, Co-chair Bailey, members of the committee, thank you for giving the department a chance to give you an update on the implementation of 3672. For the record, I'm Anthony Buckley. I'm an administrator with the Department of Energy. And joining me at the table is Maureen Bach, the Energy Incentives Program Manager. Just to start out, as you are aware, 3672 has given us a great opportunity to take another look at what used to be the Betsy program and some other programs under the department's control. The biomass producer tax, biomass producer and collector changes, we've held rulemaking. We anticipate filing the permanent rules in October on that program. The incentives program is the old Betsy program. We've chosen to call it an energy incentives program based on the fact that the legislature provided us the ability to provide grants and tax credits. So therefore, the change in term to incentives program. The old Betsy program We've issued notices and held public hearings, or will be holding public hearings through October and November, and anticipate filing permanent rules in November. For public outreach on 3672, as I speak, there is a webinar in process right now. It's the second of two webinars on the rulemaking for 3672. We've reached out and have conversated and are planning additional meetings with external stakeholder groups. We met with the Energy Advisory Committee on September 14th. Again, the webinars, we've had two that have occurred, one going on right now. We are also in discussion around program.
Mr. Buckley, let me just ask you real quick. That's new to me and probably not to anybody else. A webinar, I can imagine what that is. Who are the participants for the webinars?
So the webinar is the department giving this presentation similar to this, and we've chose the webinar format because it allowed for greater participation throughout the state. In the Monday webinar, we had, I believe, at least 225 participants throughout the state. We couldn't accommodate that large an audience in the building. During the webinar, it's unfair to call it interactive, but it allows the participants to submit questions to the department. The department can, which we didn't respond at that point in time, but we get the opportunity to gather those questions, and as you'll see further in the presentation, some other steps we've taken, we have frequently asked questions that are posted on our website. We add those questions with the already existing frequently asked questions.
Thank you.
So again, it allowed greater exposure.
Thank you.
Okay. As I said, we are contemplating program fees. There will be a public hearing. Will be scheduled in conjunction with the rulemaking. The sunsetting of the old Betsy program. 3672 ended as the Betsy program as we know it. Effective July 1st, 2011, except for the applications for pre-certs that were received prior to April 15th and projects already holding pre-certs. If you recall in the bill, those applications that we received after April 15th were no longer eligible for a tax credit. We returned 583 of those applications.
Yeah, just a second, Representative Boone.
Yeah, what was the response to that?
Co-Chair Gilliam, Representative Boone, it was mixed. A lot of unhappiness, but it was a mixed response with more people being displeased than more people being, I would say no one was pleased with it.
Follow up.
Yeah.
Was there any way that you could have given them a heads up for those? I assume that this was, you know, because the bill didn't take place until July 1st. And then it kind of backdated that time frame. And that to me, I mean, I've always had a little problem with that. I'm just wondering, were people given any kind of notification of that, like your application may be rejected due to if this bill passes or not, you know, something like that?
Mr. Kocher, I might jump in actually on that question and
sure.
For the department.
Is that okay?
And just comment from the perspective of the Joint Tax Credit Committee and in the work that we did on that. I don't think the department was in a position to have made that notification at that time, given the timing with which the bill was constructed and the look back date within the bill. Other members of this committee who are on that committee can comment as well, but I think part of the intention there from the committee was to ensure that we didn't trigger a gold rush at the end of the program and to try to pick a time that coincided with tax filing for that year, and knowing that there would be perhaps some folks there, but no matter what date you pick, ending a program like that early while at the same time preventing a run on the state's resources during a time of extreme budgetary challenges was going to be a delicate process no matter what. So I think that was the intention of the committee when the bill was crafted, and I think their department is just responding to that.
Follow up with either side. I'm just curious because I'm sure we'll start hearing more of this. But what What is the response to that when you return it? Did you write a letter and say, I'm sorry because this bill passed and this is why? Was there some sort of explanation, or was the thing just returned and said stamp too late or something, or, you know?
Co-Chair Gillen, Co-Chair Bailey, Representative Boone. The department, I can say, took great pains to communicate what were the changes that were occurring. With the refunds, because people paid fees, we provided letters of explanation. We also worked with our partners, ETO, the Energy Trust of Oregon, to help. ETO has developed a bonus incentive program to compensate where there's a deficiency created by the loss of the Betsy. So there were great measures taken to communicate these changes.
One final follow-up. I just wanted to say, because some people were just coming on board, and at the same time we were considering, thank you, Barb, this action, they were reading about, you know, in magazines on airplanes, you know, and stuff like that, you know, here's the opportunity to get a Betsy mm-hmm. or a Retsy or whatever. And that, I think it was, you know, I had a couple of people ask me, oh, this sounds good, what is it and how does it work? And so, you know, I think it was kind of going like that for a while, but I'm glad to hear mm-hmm. that you at least explained it. So,
can I ask you a clarifying please. Question? Just to clarify, the April 15th deadline that you're referencing here is for applications. Is that correct?
For new applications.
New applications,
yes.
Correct. Follow-up. So, and that's not, that was not a deadline for pre-certs, correct?
And if I can, to clarify in my mind, existing pre-certs, this was the application, the April 15 date pertains to new, brand new, in-the-door applications for a pre-cert.
Correct.
Pre-certs that were, had been, applications for pre-cert received prior to that, the department spent the month of June focusing on clearing that backlog. Those were honored, so pre-certs were awarded. If you came in on April 16th, you missed the opportunity.
So, to clarify then, if you had a pre-certification as of the July 1st date, whether it was an existing pre-cert as of that April 15th date or an application that was then subsequently pre-certified during the course of, say, the legislative session mm-hmm. before July 1st, then that pre-certification was honored by the department, or if construction and work had begun. Is
yes.
that correct?
And if I can expand just a little bit, we were issuing pre-certs up through June 30th. So the cutoff for new applications was April 15th. We had a fair number of applications waiting to be processed that had been received prior to April 15th. So you had applications being processed on June 30th that had been received prior.
So the only affected group, just to make sure we're clear on this on the record, mm-hmm. Were people who applied for new applications for pre-certification after April 15th, but who and who did not already have a pre-certification. So there had been no notification from the department to any of these people, these applicants, that they were approved for or in line for a Betsy.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Continuing on.
Anybody else? Does that conclude the...
No, I've got plenty more. If you want to let me off the hook, I'm glad.
No, I just don't... Representative Benz, you look like you're about to...
Ask him a question.
Yeah.
I was just going to comment that anytime you take away free money, you have a lot of angry people.
Yes.
And I think that's, it sounds kind of harsh, but that's what we did.
Yes.
And it was... it's sad because we had been so fortunate in how well that program turned out. And I'm anxious to compliment you on your efforts.
Thank you.
And I just don't think that we can avoid the challenges that go with what we're about.
The change. Please continue.
So Section 1 of HB 3672 provides that for a facility other than renewable energy resource equipment manufacturing, a taxpayer can get a tax credit unless, and this goes into our discussion, the application for pre-cert was filed before April 15th, 2011. Mm-hmm. The preliminary certification was received before July 1st, 2011. And they received final certification before January 11, 2013, or the project owner can demonstrate evidence of beginning construction before April 15, 2011. That last part is a new twist that was brought about with the bill. the bill provided a six-month extension to the previously existing sunset date. In order to get a further extension, you have to have considerable construction occurring prior to the April 15th cutoff date. The department right now is working on defining what that evidence of beginning construction means. For renewable resource equipment manufacturing, for the projects we are looking at, what the federal definitions are, we're considering items such as building permits and other items that would demonstrate that they've made significant progress in moving forward with the project. Internally, our activities have included internal teams that have looked at the created rules. Those rules, I would like to note, the draft rules have been posted to the department's website. They are out and available, and we look for public comments on those. The teams included people who process the paperwork, subject matter experts, and we have an inspection and compliance staff that in 2010, the legislator saw fit to provide the department with compliance personnel. We're currently establishing a program design. This includes, you've given us more sideboards around the dollars associated with the tax incentives. That invites competition. So what are the competitive criteria? For the renewable energy grants, we're working on what the criteria for qualifications will be there. We are coordinating with the Department of Revenue. As you may recall, the bill provides the authority to the Department of Revenue to conduct auctions for tax credits. We have had many conversations with them and trying to align our issuance of tax credits and their receipt or sale of, our issuance of the grants and their sale of the tax credits. Again, we've posted frequently asked questions on our website. We've established and published timelines for rulemaking activities. We've had stakeholder meetings. We've held webinars and public hearings on the biomass producer or collector tax credit, and we anticipate filing those rules in October. So, again, pointing back to what 3672 provides us, it provides a number of things or recrafts the tax incentives program in the state of Oregon for not just the energy, but other programs that I don't want to go into because they're not my forte. But 3672 for the Department of Energy created three subset or new programs, the conservation tax credit, the renewable grants program, and the transportation tax credit. So with conservation, these are projects that are defined as those for which the first year energy savings or yields a simple payback period of more than 3 years. We have ongoing work where we're establishing the criteria and the timing of the allocation. With $28 million in incentives available there over this biennium, it is incumbent upon us to provide something that provides an equitable or a consistent distribution over time. To just open the doors today and say $28 million is available right now, it's the gold rush. I want to get in front of someone else before to make ensure that I get my tax credit. So we are working with, opportunity announcements. We anticipate having three opportunity announcements throughout the rest of the biennium. The timing between those opportunity announcements, we look to do one every 6 months. The legislature itself also called out projects of less than $20,000. These are small-scale projects. The legislature has asked that those projects, for lack of a better term, have a streamlined process. We've done some analysis of the historical data and saw that our experience is typically we see at least $2 million to $2.5 million in project applications that are under $20,000. So of the $28 million, we've kind of landed on this number of $2.5 million. It's about 15 to 17% of the overall amount that would be set aside for small-scale projects. On the renewable side, the renewable grants, these are where individual grants that will be awarded that may not exceed $250,000 or 35% of project costs. Ongoing work, again, is determining the criteria for the applicants that will receive these awards, establishing timing and allocation of the cap, developing the application requirements and the process, developing grant agreements, including performance agreement language. And we, again, are working with Department of Revenue on the auction, and I have further details about the auction further down, further in this presentation.
Renewable refers to the type of energy.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Thank you. It is renewable energy, not a renewable grant. Department of Revenue has proposed it. It's a sealed bid with each bidder able to submit multiple binding bids. And again, just so for the audience, I clarify, it is the tax credit that is being auctioned off. The proceeds of that auction will then go into a fund, and from the Department of Energy will put those in our fund. The Department of Revenue will take and make awards of grants to project owners based on what results or what the Department of Revenue was able to achieve in their auction sale. So it's up to $1.5 million or $3 million for the biennium, $1.5 million a year. Credits will be sold in $1,000 increments with 1,500 credits available. Energy and revenue will develop frequently asked questions. Energy will promote the auction with a link to the revenue hosted website and the forms. Timelines for the auction. Right now, it's anticipated that the revenue will open the auction on Monday, October 24th. The auction will stay open until Friday, November 4th. Payments will be due on Thursday, November 10th. Revenue determines winning bids the week of November 14th. They will then... Sorry, was there a question?
Anybody? Yes, Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The discussions we've had previously on how that process would work required the involvement of the Department of Revenue and their review of the credit instrument. So in your last line there, ODE gets a list of the winners and issues the credit. Is that still a sheet of paper that says tax credit across the face of it and you hand it to somebody? And if so, ODE must have been involved. And is that document transferable by the buyer?
It's eligible for pass-through, I believe, is your question, Representative Benz.
Follow up.
Yes.
My question was, when we had this discussion 2 years ago in revenue, the reason we couldn't get to the point you've now reached is in struggling with how we would manage that certificate of tax credit, because it's like a negotiable instrument. It's like a dollar bill, mm-hmm. At least, and we stalled out in trying to figure out how we would keep track of the thing, because it is an original document subject to all kinds of interesting forgery issues and things like that. Is this part of the rulemaking process that you guys are going through addressing the form of this particular device?
Co-chairs, Representative Benz, members of the committee, my name is Maureen Bach for the record. I've been working with the Department of Revenue on the auction piece. They are doing temporary rules to facilitate this. We are going to be drafting a certificate which we will issue when they provide us with the list of names, and then they will maintain that list to verify who is using those certificates. So they will actually police who is using certificates. They will also manage the transferability. Department of Revenue.
Follow up. This is getting way too far in the weeds. I was just curious because we recognized in revenue how complex that process could be. And I'm just curious if it's turning out that way or if it's far more simple than we had anticipated.
Representative Benz, member of the committee, it has been a complicated process, but we are fortunate in revenue has experience in this process through the film and video tax credit auctions. So we've been leveraging that knowledge with them.
Thank you.
So again, that was the timeline for the auction. Transportation credits. These are the bill allows for tax credits for transit services and alternative fuel infrastructure that phases out over the next 4 years. We've created and published criteria to dictate action taken if the cap is reached. We are establishing timing of the allocation of the cap across the biennium, and we are developing new forms and applications for the transportation credit. For the transit side of the transportation credit, this allows tax credits for public or nonprofit entities that provide transit services to members of the public and receive public benefits. Again, we're in the process of creating and publishing the criteria to allocate these credits, establishing the allocation across the biennium, and developing new forms, working closely with the Department of Transportation's public transit group to align our offering with some of the definitions and the policies that they have in place. For the alternative fuel vehicle infrastructure, this is facilities for mixing, storing, compressing, or dispensing fuels for alternative fuel vehicles and other equipment. The groups internally are establishing the standards for those facilities that include the blender pumps, alternative fuels storage tanks, electric vehicles charging stations, compressed natural gas, propane dispensing stations. So ongoing work. So it's fair to say that there are challenges, and the challenges that we're working through now are with specific to alternative fuel infrastructure lie in determining how to measure the reductions in purchased energy, how to determine performance agreement, how determining how performance agreements will be administered, and determining how to measure the number and types of jobs created and or sustained. So focusing on conservation, the statute requires that preference be given to those projects with the highest energy savings over the 5-year credit allowance period per tax credit dollar. The statute requires that the department to compare the projects of similar technology types against each other, taking into account the amount of energy saved over the life of the equipment, market or industry sector, expected life of the equipment, compared to simple payback factors defined by rule. Under Betsy, it was defined as the date of financial commitment. However, this was ambiguous. The idea is to require a building permit, and I apologize, I mixed up my paragraphs here. This is with regard to under construction, when we talk about projects that have, what have they committed prior to April 15th? Is it shovel in the ground permits? We are contemplating that it would be building permits and two pieces of site-specific documentation, such as excavation receipts. Representative Bailey, I believe during the presentation of this bill, you had some concerns about what under construction would, how the department should define that, and we're trying to address those concerns for everyone. So again, the projects under small scale projects under $20,000. So streamlined process. We are challenged right now with the bill says, calls out the small scale and asks to streamline without a pre-certification process. So the work groups are now working with through what does that process look like? When does that project come in and make claim for its credit? What do they need to present in order to make that claim? What supporting evidence do they need in order to get the credit? This we believe will increase our inspection activities. The credit will be based on a formula, and we'll need to determine eligibility dates. So types of projects under the small scale term that we use are cooling, ozone laundry facilities, infrared comfort, agricultural, industrial projects, boiler vent dampers, and piping types. This is just some of the projects that we believe we'll continue to see on this small scale category. I don't want to exhaust and go through detail by detail on these. Under the renewable grants, again, it's a tax credit auction. Rules be adopted by revenue. And the auction will be conducted by revenue. The first auction will take place this fall. Grant opportunity announcements and award process to follow, announce opening up the opportunity in the fall. Successful grantees enter into grant agreements with the Department of Energy. And terms may include construction operation requirements, reporting requirements, the disbursement schedule, and remedies for failure to comply. So those are, again, all details that are being worked out right now. Transportation, under transportation on transit services, this aligns with conversations that we've had with the Department of Transportation, their public transit division, and making sure that we are in alignment with that program in issuing our credit. It proposes to use a tier for public and nonprofit transit providers. Applicants would need to submit information about cost and funding sources. No project would receive more than 100% of their eligible project costs from all funding sources. The vehicle purchase or lease expenses would not be eligible under this incentive. Administrative costs would be capped at 15% of total project cost. The maximum eligible project cost could be capped by vehicle miles and reduced by a certain factor based on percent of urban or rural miles driven. And the projects would have to show significant petroleum reduction. On the alternative fuel vehicle infrastructure, this includes, again, the vehicles for mixing, storing, compressing, or dispensing fuels for alternative fuel vehicles and other equipment. Fuels could include biofuels, compressed natural gas, propane, electricity. Alternative fuel tank siting costs would be eligible project cost under this program. Biodigester cost would not be eligible except for the cost after the filter. Allowable project costs would be net of other incentives. Under 3672, you also addressed the RETC program. The changes to the Residential Energy Tax Credit Program take effect on January 1st of 2012. It eliminates appliances and alternative vehicles from qualifying for the credit. We're amending the RETC rules to conform to the statute and should have those in place by the January 1st date. So other issues that we're dealing with or that we are managing through in implementing this bill, staffing, fees, and then identifying other areas that the bill may have exposed that we want to bring to your attention in the February session. So going through these, under resources, when you go from a program, the Betsy program, which was this size, to putting the sideboards and making it this size, and then coming down to 3672 and making it this size, it's addressing the staffing need that was there for this program. So we are working through those. The base level required to process the work, you don't need as many staff, so we're trying to reallocate or reassess what our staffing needs are, and we've got some good talent in the program, retaining the good talent and making sure that they remain productive and then know that they're valued in managing whether it's the incentive program or some other program within the organization. The fees, it should be a cost recovery model. So the staffing level will drive the fees. The volumes will be likely to be less so under the 3672, so the cost will have to be recovered from smaller pool of applicants. What I'd like to kind of put on your minds is while 3672 sunsets Betsy, there's still a tremendous amount of work there. There's a huge amount of work. We do have a graph that represents, it's the proverbial pig through the snake. The old Betsy program, as far as the certificates that are out there, there are over 4,000 pre-certifications out there that are waiting to be processed, and it's the department sitting and waiting for those final applications to come in. That affects the staff that just does the processing and the reviewing, but it also affects the pass-through activity. What we found is at least 80% of those applications on file for pre-cert, 80% of those have chosen the pass-through option. So there's a tremendous amount of work there. The fee structure that we're contemplating would compensate in a cost recovery fashion the old work that needs to be completed and the new work that's being undertaken.
Let me interrupt you for a second and ask on the staffing issue. You're the administrator. Are these folks reporting to you? Is this your division? Are you the manager for that area?
Co-Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Bailey, representatives of the committee. I'm the administrator. Maureen Bach is the incentives program manager. So those personnel report directly to Maureen.
I wanted to ask a couple questions on this. You make several very good points about the difficulty of the transition. Backlog. I don't know if you're saying more people are taking the pass-through option than had previously done that, therefore requiring more work, or is the pass-through about the same as it's always been in the backlog?
I would say pass-through activities have increased.
Have increased.
Because it offers, and I apologize, Co-Chair Gillum, Co-Chair Bailey, representative of the committee, the pass-through option allows that opportunity to monetize that credit. And again, 80% of the pre-certifications that we have existing today have chosen that pass-through option.
So granted, more sophisticated, more labor-intensive, but at some point, to Representative Ben's point earlier, the free money's been cut off.
Yes.
You, I think, I've read there were 17 FTEs approximately working on Betsy. However long that transition is, at some point, we're going to have staff reductions, I would assume. You know, say a little bit more about how many FTEs we're looking at eliminating or how soon that's going to happen. What's a reasonable transition time?
Representative, co-chairs, representatives, members of the committee, my name is Maureen Bach. We have been looking at staffing and when we anticipate the Betsy workload to actually move through. We're also looking at how we stagger those opportunity announcements so we don't create another bulge for ourselves, so we're having the workload come in a more streamlined fashion, more predictable fashion. So there is a slide down further that shows when we think the bulge will happen, which is somewhere in the 2013-14 timeframe. And then after that, we do anticipate ramping down significantly and having a standard smaller workload distributed more evenly throughout the biennium. At that point, we should be able to reduce staff and probably allocate more staff to tasks that get people weeded out sooner, if you will. So there's a funneling effect. Applications come in. If they're complete and they're ready for technical review, they would move on. If they're not, they are weeded out of the process at the beginning instead of going through and getting some kind of certification and then being weeded out downstream. So that's what we're looking at doing now with the staffing model. We're also doing some review of the amount of time it takes to actually process that work as we do it now and looking at some process changes.
Well, my colleagues on this committee that both serve here and on the other tax committee, Benz and Bailey, others on this committee? You have a much better grasp of this than I would. If you have any other comments about this, we can talk about it offline if you have any comments at this point. I am concerned about the length of transition. I'm not saying I have the answer, but it is of concern to me. Anybody else? If not, we can keep moving. Please.
Mr. Co-Chair, I'll jump
in. Mr. Co-Chair.
I would also, if I might, emphasize that I think we are in a transition process of completely ending one program and creating several new ones from whole cloth. And it certainly is one that we're keeping our eye on in a number of places as well on how that transition goes.
Okay, that's helpful.
Members of the committee, this slide does represent what we think the workload decrease will be. As you can see, there's a spike in the 2011-2012 timeframe for final certification. So that workload would be coming in, probably ending then at 2013 when the statute requires us to have finalized projects. So that's that big purple spike you see there. Then we're ramping up the project. So that blue line in the back represents what we think the volume will be for initial applications.
and you see it kind of has small fluctuations. Those would correspond roughly with the opportunity announcements in the various program areas. And then you can see the pass-through workload is slightly less than final certification. That represents what we think the pass-through activity will be. As we have more experience with the new programs, we'll be able to refine this, but this is based on what we have as historical information in the agency. And that green line in the front then is the preliminary certs, and you can see it dropped off precipitously in 2011, so it kind of flatlines then through the remainder of the program. So that's what we're trying to staff to, and we're mindful that we need to be monitoring that and not having people sit idle. So we want to make sure that our processes really are streamlined and that people are fully employed when they're doing this program.
Co-Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Bailey, Representative Kennedy. To your point, Representative Gilliam, I would add that noting the number in the report you saw of FTE, that's a mix of FTE. In the program, we have limited duration positions that have a sunset date on them. We also have some temporary staff. The program ramped up to address the huge demand that the Betsy program experienced over time. So we are very cognizant of the issue of too many FTE and how we manage and throughout the new program. So we also mentioned fees. We're looking at the issue of fees as a continuous process, continuing throughout the process. There would be an application fee, and I would tell you now we haven't determined what those fees are. We are working with our stakeholders and our internal work groups to kind of find that what those numbers are. So the application fee, in a competitive process, there will be winners and losers. Those winners going forward in the process would then, similar to what we did with the TIER program in renewables under 3680, when they're invited to continue on and go through the technical review, there would be a technical review fee. There are amendment fees in existence today. So the project that you present today, you need to amend for scope or some other reason in the future requires handling, there would be an amendment fee. There's a final certification fee contemplated. Again, when you saw the graph, you saw that the huge backlog of pre-certs just waiting. It's the department just waiting for the project owner to signal to us, hey, I'm ready to move forward and finalize this. We would have a final certification fee. That typically occurs you can take up to 3 years to final your project. So while we may ramp that staff down today, you could have a deluge of, depending on what the activity is, of final activity. Inspection fee, again, under 3680 in 2010 in the special session, we were authorized to bring about compliance officers. We have two compliance officers for the state. Those compliance officers are busy, and they are finding and they're substantiating the claims for credits. They're challenging other claims for credits that don't, the project wasn't done to the specs in the pre-certification. The project may not have been done. To Representative Bent's earlier comment, this we see as a complement to the revenue activity. Our compliance officers are going out in the field and putting eyeballs on these projects now. We're working with some of our partners, such as the ETO, for smaller projects to rely on their audit information. So we see it's not uncommon for a compliance officer to go to somewhere in southeastern Oregon or anywhere in the state, and it's a day's travel, and the project owner not show up. So there would be a reinspection fee there. It's kind of this accountability on all parties that we're trying to enforce here. The pass-through, again, we talked about pass-through activity. Right now, in pass-through, we have about an inventory, we like to say, of at least $200 million in tax credits looking for partners. That requires a tremendous investment in time. And the pass-through has developed and grown over time from the original intent. Early on,
the department was really involved in finding partners for the public sector. So municipalities, hospitals that chose pass-through, couldn't take advantage of the credit, we assisted in finding their partners. That has morphed. The private sector is interested in having us find them partners. So that 80% number I mentioned earlier, much of that is private sector activity. They are relying on us to find them a pass-through partner. So our staff spends a tremendous amount of time there, and it has not paid for itself in the past. We're looking to make that a cost recovery type model also. So with that, I'd close and invite any questions that you may have.
Well, we interrupted you along the way. any other questions on the presentation? Representative Benz.
No. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Do we have any idea? It's too bad we can't take all of the work we've done on this thing and sell it to some other state, because the sheer amount of work over the last two or three years is just amazing. And I know that we're getting closer to getting it right just about the time we don't have the money to fund it, which is really unfortunate. But looking forward, we still have some money and we're still using the program, and that's all fine. But do we have a number for how much we've put into, how your department has put into this, in developing, designing this system that now isn't, I don't know if the right word is, being fully optimized, but at least we have a system.
A number meaning cost?
Cost, how much out of pocket for your involvement?
Representative Gilliam, Representative Bailey, members of the committee. Representative Benz, I couldn't give you that number today. We could do some research and figure out, see what we could come up, we could find. What I would say, and I thank you for your compliments to the program, that's been years, because some of those people in the program have been around for a number of years. They have laid the foundation for where we're at today. You know, we've suffered through some trials, but there's been a lot of good work over the years, and they have participated greatly in addressing the changes that the legislature has asked us to put in on the program. But as far as the cost of the program, whether it be on an annual basis or a biennial basis, we'd have to do some work for that to get that number.
And one follow-up to this, Mr. Chair.
All right.
It's unfortunate that the program enjoys now some negative veneer, we'll call it, because I think a lot of good was done with the dollars spent. But the focus seems to be on where the dollars might have been better spent. Mm-hmm. And so it would be nice at some point if there was some summary of this program's kind of a look back. And this is what this investment by the state of Oregon resulted in. And I don't know. I know we've seen different reports. It's probably too soon to really look at this. But it would be interesting, to say the least, after the dust settles.
Representative Bailey, members of the committee, I'd love to follow up with you offline to talk through that some more.
Thanks, sir.
And we have an opportunity here maybe for a new revenue source in maybe patents or trademarks on our legislation.
Mr. Co-Chair, every other state is broke, so there'd have to be some sort of pass-through option, maybe a transferability of the credit. To
more FTEs, never mind.
Yeah.
Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would benefit, and perhaps other members of the committee, with a copy of the of today's presentation.
Thank you. If you'll provide one, we will make sure all members of the committee get that.
Members of the committee, we will also provide you with a link of the pages where you can find additional information.
Thank you. We'll distribute it accordingly. With that, we will move on to our next Department of Energy subject, which is the two-year, not to be confused with the 10-year, the two-year plan, and Deanna Enright, we invite your input.
Chair Gilliam, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Diana Enright. I am the communications manager for the Oregon Department of Energy. And for this 2011-13 biennial energy plan, I was part writer, part editor, part historian, and part researcher. So what follows is kind of a historical look back at the energy plans that we've done in the past, the current energy plan, and as you mentioned, how that sets the foundation possibly for the 10-year energy strategy. So looking back on more than 35 years of plans and reports that I found in the agency archives, one theme came through, and that was that energy planning in Oregon is set on a foundation of conservation. It is the cheapest energy resource that we can acquire. But the plans have also relied on agency technical staff and subject matter experts who work with their stakeholders and others and look down the road at what are the challenges and opportunities coming in Oregon's energy future. So a little bit of energy history. The Department of Energy was created in 1975. ORS 469 said, because the legislature said that Oregon should not be left a legacy of vanished or depleted resources, it created the Oregon Department of Energy. And we are designed to be a central repository of energy information, inform the public about ways to conserve energy, be a clearinghouse for energy research, prepare contingency plans, which we do with our petroleum contingency plan, and develop comprehensive energy plans. I'm including this because this is the first Oregon energy plan that I could find. It was actually issued in January of 1975, prior to the creation of the Oregon Department of Energy. It looks like the 70s. It came out of the Governor's Office of Energy Research and Planning. It is filled with interesting and valuable information, and it's also a very valuable document. When last I looked, it was available on Amazon.com for $329. So if you have a copy, it's worth some money.
I've heard this album.
Yes. It looks like a poster for a band in my district.
We're waiting for the movie version. It was considered a groundbreaking document at the time because the main question running through the entire document is, what is Oregon's energy future? Is it going to be nuclear or solar? So in 1977, the agency was issuing an annual report at first, and then later a biennial report. But the first annual report came out in 1977. It covered energy use, energy resources, forecast modeling, and the results. One interesting note on page 3 of the 1977 report to show that energy issues are indeed cyclical, it emphasized that there is no simple or static relationship between energy consumption, employment, and economic growth, but that clearly energy is a prerequisite to job-producing economic activity. So you need energy to have jobs. In 1980, energy planning changed on a regional basis because Congress passed the Northwest Power Planning Act, and that set up what is now called the Northwest Power and Conservation Council. Planning changed, and it's now done on a regional basis, and the council prepares plans on energy and protecting and enhancing fish and wildlife. So over the years, there have been many energy plans and planning documents. We've also issued a number of other reports besides just energy plans. There have been lots of plans and reports. The Oregon Energy Sunbook on solar energy in 1980. The Energy Guide for Oregon Grocers and How They Could Save Energy in Their Grocery Stores in 1982. Energy and Conservation in Water and Wastewater Systems. Energy Management in State Buildings. Commercial Energy Study of Restaurants. An Oregon Automobile Survey, Driving Patterns and Driver Attitudes, which is, we still have a copy of that. It's a very interesting document, issued in 1985. But it didn't end in 85. There were more reports. In 1988, we had the Oregon Energy Investment Report, and in 1990, the Oregon Petroleum Contingency Plan and the Oregon Task Force on Global Warming. So the first biennial plan came out in 1985. And it was at the legislative direction of Senate Bill 212 in 1983. And it said that Oregon energy policy establishes an ethic of energy efficiency which must be sustained even during a surplus. And looking back at all the reports since 1985, there's a basic format to our energy plans. We have a chapter on energy supply and demand, conservation, renewable, and conventional resources, energy issues that we're looking at, including environmental and health issues, and an action plan for where we need to go. So where are we today with energy planning? In January, we issued the 2011-2013 energy plan, and it follows the basic format of the previous plans. There's a section on Oregon's energy history, supply and demand, energy issues facing Oregon, Oregon's energy future, and a number of appendices, including an explanation of all the acronyms that you might hear. We tried to capture those as we go along and make sure we've got explanations of those. So the current plan, the chapter on energy supply and demand, is basically what we call Energy 101. It talks about where do we get our energy, how do we use our energy. We get a lot of our information from the U.S. Department of Energy, Energy Information Administration, the EIA. And they collect state data, and if you go to their website, you can look at their profile of Oregon and our energy consumption. They have a lot of interesting facts on their website, including that Oregonians spend more than $14 billion a year on all forms of energy, most of that money leaving the state. And Oregon only produces about one-third of the energy it uses. Some of the other interesting statistics is that nationwide we are 38th in overall energy consumption. Wyoming actually consumes the most energy of any state in the country, and New York consumes the least. But then New York also has the second highest residential electricity rates in the country. We have a chapter on energy issues facing Oregon. One issue we dealt with in the current report are the transmission line projects that are currently going through the state siting process. Two large electric transmission lines, Cascade Crossing, which is proposed from Boardman to Salem by PGE, and the Idaho Power Project of Boardman to Hemingway. And in Oregon's Energy Future chapter, we look at the fact that whatever the future is, it should be built again on that foundation of energy, conservation, and efficiency. And some of the things we're looking at are electric vehicles, and how does that fit in, and how electricity will become more important as we move towards electric vehicles. And I wanted to show you some of the other plans that exist outside of what the agency produces, because we are also influenced in a broad energy context by a number of other organizations and plans, including the Six Power Plan from the Conservation Council, the Integrated Resource Plans that go through the Public Utility Commission and are provided by the utilities, the Pacific Northwest Utilities Conference Committee, the Global Warming Commission and its current roadmap to 2020, Senate Bill 1059 and House Bill 2001, the Sustainable Transportation Initiatives, the Western Interconnection Plan Working Group and their look at transmission lines on a regional basis, the Western Governors Association and their mapping of renewable energy zones in the West, and Northwest Seed and its energy plans that it's doing with tribal nations. So looking back again over kind of the history of plans and looking forward, we are entering a more diverse energy world. Information is exchanged at rapid speed, much more so than in the past. The issues are becoming increasingly more complex, global, and controversial, and more people are paying attention to where their energy is coming from and how it's being used. So to get back to the mention of a 10-year energy strategy, how does our 2-year biennial energy plan kind of plug into that? Our energy plans have looked at use and consumption and forecasts and scenarios. But when you look at an overall broad energy strategy, you need to move beyond just the energy world. You need to look at land use planning, at water resources, at affordable housing, at economic development, at efficient product purchases, and at transportation. So these are some slides of old historic energy plans and some of the graphics that were in those. This is a schematic of modeling looking at the use of appliances in Oregon. So your plans can include some modeling. Your plans can include issue discussion such as electromagnetic fields, the intermittent nature of renewable energy, or climate change. And plans can show the accomplishments, where we've been and what we've accomplished. In 1982, the department's sixth annual report noted that Oregonians have been generally enthusiastic about investing in energy conservation and renewable energy, even when the economic times are tough. It said, despite prospects of a bleak economy, at least in the short term, Oregon homeowners show a strong willingness to invest in measures to control the rising costs of electricity, natural gas, and home heating oil. And your plans can also and should have specific objectives. Where are you trying to head? Do you want to obtain all available conservation? Do you want to reduce our reliance on fossil fuels and become more energy independent? Help promote emerging technologies? Keep more of that $14 billion in Oregon? Or reduce greenhouse gas emissions, or a combination of all of those? And finally, I want to end with some tidbits I took from some of the old energy plans. In the second annual report we issued in 1978, there was a quote from Governor Bob Straub. What an energy plan is. It's good, solid information. It's the foundation of good decisions. And energy decisions made in the next months and years will have a lasting impact on Oregon's energy future. And what a plan is not. A plan is not a wish list. It reflects today's realities, and it recognizes that times will change. Change always brings the need for new and different responses and actions. And finally, from Governor Vicatia in the New Energy Directions for Oregon in 1979, we live in a world of dwindling energy supplies and rising costs. We are vulnerable, but we are not helpless. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions or comments?
I appreciate not only the report, but also the retrospect on other reports. In addition to obviously the issues of energy planning for Oregon, I'm interested in a part of the plan that has that talks about the department's plan, particularly as it relates to funding and spending. You made a comment, and that I'm interested to follow up on, that this report, for instance, can be foundational to that 10-year report, mm-hmm. which I accept. But I'm wondering, is there a way to plan on consolidating these two reports? You know, there's a statute requirement, I think, for the 2-year plan.
Correct.
I don't think it's a statute requirement for the 10-year. I'm not against the 10-year. I'm just making that point.
Chair Gilliam, I'm familiar with our 469 statute that requires the 2-year biennial energy plan.
So, you know, maybe this is not your department, but it seems to me we ought to think about, I think ESA funds are funding both. Is there a way to consolidate, to save some money? We're doing two reports, and maybe they're distinctive enough that they just have to be done that way. But I just, from a practical standpoint, why aren't we finding way cost savings there?
Chair Gilliam and members of the committee, I think that's a question we're asking ourselves at this point. And when we have more information, we'll be able to come back to you and answer that question.
Okay. And I guess on the 10-year plan, when is it? I missed that point. When are we supposed to be hearing that plan? Or do you know? I don't know what the schedule is on the 10-year plan.
Chair Gilliam, members of the committee, I think we're awaiting details on that.
Okay. So as far as you know, the plan itself focuses on the external energy issues for the state of Oregon. The quotes that you use and so forth point that direction, and it's obviously appropriate. But the plan is not talking about internal planning in terms of spending, in terms of conservation of energy department resources. Is that a correct statement?
Chair Gilliam, let's see if I can rephrase your question. You're asking about, does this biennial energy plan get at agency spending?
Yeah, that's part of what I'm wondering.
Not really. This is in statute designed to be the planning document for the state as a whole as in energy planning, and I think you'd find that information probably in our budget document as far as how the agency spends its money.
So as far as you understand that the historical sort of purpose of the plan is to talk about the external policies in Oregon, energy policies. This is not the report to talk about spending with inside the industry or the department.
Chair Gilliam, that's correct, because when the agency was created and the legislature said Oregon will not be left a legacy of vanished or depleted resources, that was the direction for the agency to go forth and make sure the state does not have vanished or depleted resources, so that the citizens of Oregon have enough energy to go about their daily lives.
We are joined by another.
Good afternoon. Mr. Chair, for the record, Lisa Pinero. I'm the Government Relations Manager for the Department of Energy. And what I think you're driving to is the question of appropriate uses of the ESA funds. And in terms of planning for those uses of ESA funds, which fund a large portion of the activities of the Department of Energy. And no, just to sum up, the energy plan that Diana has discussed with you here today, as well as that 10-year energy strategy that is the governor's initiative, there's no relationship to those documents or to that activity with regard to the management and the funding of the Department of Energy. Now, is it true that the ESA, the energy supplier assessment funds the work that goes into the planning? If that is, yes, true. With regard to managing those funds, the Department of Energy, since this beginning of this current biennium that we're in, the 2011-13, has restructured our funding structure so that we are better able to track the use of the ESA money. And that is a conversation that would take a great deal of time, and I would welcome an opportunity. In fact, I will follow up with you and talk to you about that at a later date. And we have talked with our Ways and Means Subcommittee on that structure and the reorganization of the funding streams within the department. I hope that is somewhat helpful.
No, it is helpful, and I think I don't want to confuse the two issues, but I will say, speaking for this co-chair, and I'm interested in having discussion with my new co-chair, that interested in this committee talking in depth, and I'm happy to talk with you first and offline, but I also think this it's appropriate for this committee to talk about that, particularly the ESA, in these budget times, how we're using the money, and so forth. And if that's not part of this plan, I can accept that. But what triggers it in my mind is what I already said. We're spending some of those funds to produce this report, and we'll spend some of those funds to produce the 10-year report, the schedule of which we don't know. And it's an example, maybe one of several, I don't know, where we might want to look at efficiencies within our own department. Apply conservation, the concept of conservation, to how we spend money in the department. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. By your description, I understand the plans to be focusing on energy sources. But with the increasing potential for additional energy generation sources to be coming online, wave energy, hydrogen generated energy, sources of energy generation where perhaps we have had none before. I'm wondering if your report will deal at all with our ability to deliver this energy to where we need it, from where it's generated, when we need it, and its generation is a critical component of our ability to achieve the energy that Oregonians need now and into the future. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, yes, the report does cover that. There is a section in here on ocean energy, hydropower, and direct use of geothermal and other resources that are available. And then there's a section on transmission and generation and getting the energy generated to where it needs to be used. And those are some of the issues in the issues chapter in here. That's part of what the state is facing, is as demand increases and we look at more distributed generation and resources, especially renewable energy resources that are located away from where the population is, how do we get those renewable resources to where the demand is?
Well, and Mr. Chairman, not only away from where the population may be, but also away from where our traditional grid may exist.
Thank you. Representative Betts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just always interested in looking at these plans and asking who actually pays any attention to them once they're done. And I guess I could call out many different plans across the scope of my legislative experience, which once complete find their way to the shelf or into the ether of the internet where they languish. So I guess my question would be, who is, in your opinion, paying attention to our planning exercise?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, the news media actually pays great attention to our plan. As I mentioned, the first chapter is known as Energy 101. We get a lot of questions both from the media and the public as to where does my electricity come from? Where does the petroleum come from? Are there natural gas pipelines in Oregon? Where are they located? How many are being proposed? What power plants are being proposed? So people have a variety of energy questions that we can find the answers to in the document, but especially important has been that first chapter of here's how we use it, here's where it comes from.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. And that's fine, but that would be more of a information source as opposed to a plan.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I'm raising this issue is because, as many here know, I had introduced a bill suggesting a greater reliance on compressed natural gas.
Mm-hmm.
My thinking had been that this would be in the best interest of the state of Oregon because we'd have more alternative fuels available, or at least another one. And it seems to me that that is consistent with the overall concept of planning, that is, making less expensive alternative fuels available to Oregonians. But that I only use that as the foundation for the question, which is, if we're going through this exercise of planning, we ought to be focusing on something that we're then suggesting actually be done. So looking at the plan that was just presented, which of those things do you think we should be emphasizing as a group here to make happen? Is there any one thing in our plan that we should push forward with aggressively? And this gives me an opportunity, although not necessarily a totally relevant one, but as we flew back the 11 hours from Beijing 2 days ago, or three, we happen to be sitting by a young man who is an engineer working in Palo Alto. And their focus is to separate out CO2 from the total volume of gas created when you burn coal. He thinks it's going to take 5 years to reduce to be able to get to 20% of that element out. And the other 80%, will simply go into the atmosphere with no damage done. 5 years. And then he thinks we'll be able to appropriately store that 20% underground. Now, that would seem to me to be a pretty important thing that we might focus upon. But now, that's kind of an aside from the plan, but I was giving you time to actually think of what it is that's most important.
And I was thinking about how I was ending my career by answering the question.
Sorry.
We're just getting warmed up. That's a simple question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, as far as one thing that needs to go forward, I don't know if there is one thing, but I'd like to tell you about something that you're talking about a lot of applied research. And I think there's a really well-kept secret in Oregon that the state needs to look at more closely, and that is the fact that we have a national energy lab just down the road. We have Nettle Albany, the National Energy Technology Lab in Albany. It is the only U.S. Department of Energy owned and operated lab in the country. And I have done a number of projects with them, and we have been trying to figure out how the state can partner more closely with a national federal lab right in our own backyard to look at some of these. And I noticed just this week they recently received a large federal grant to do some geothermal research. They work mainly on fossil fuels and some metals technology. They can look at how to make the blades on wind turbines stronger. So I think if there was one thing I would say about how do we implement a plan, it's to take your plan and look for partnerships. Look for if you want to do CNG, what are the opportunities? Who are our partners? Who can we work with so that parts of this plan actually get implemented and don't just sit on the shelf?
Thank you.
Co-Chair Bailey, and then we'll go to Representative Witt again.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Representative Vance actually asked exactly the question that I wanted to ask with the same follow-up about the audience for this. And I think what you're hearing, if I might comment, Mr.
Please,
Co-Chair, from the committee is an appetite for really looking at what the next step is here. I think really tees up well the discussion that we'll probably have over the course of the interim around what the 10-year energy plan looks like and then how structures align around that plan. And if I might be so bold as to say, I think you're doing an exemplary job responding to a series of plans that have existed in statute, the requirement for which may be to some degree obsolete now, at least in my mind, in that we have an enormous need for the information resources, as you put it, and then there might be a bit of a bifurcation between the encyclopedic aspect of Oregon energy and the strategic planning aspect of Oregon energy, because we live in a much more complex world now. We don't print on typewriters. We don't use psychedelic font anymore. And transitions. We're still in transit. And that first volume came out before I was born.
Well, thank you. For that.
You're welcome. But I think the point is here that we have a much more complex world. We have a much more global world. We have new technologies coming online. We've made enormous strides. We have a regulatory environment, an agency environment, and a funding structure and an internal staffing allocation and all of those things that go into what is the plan, how do we pay for that plan, how do we get entities to align to that plan, how do we work with our federal partners, how do we work with our regional state partners, how do we work with the private sector, and how do we do that in a way that has leadership attached to it. I don't know the answer to that. I think that's the question a lot of us are asking. I think that's what we're trying to get our heads around, and I think hopefully we'll be able to engage in that discussion over the course of the interim. But I'm ready to be corrected by it. I don't want to speak for anybody else on the committee.
I don't know if we're going to correct him, but you're up next, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm curious whether your report will be evaluating the vulnerabilities and survivabilities of our state's energy infrastructure in light of potential catastrophic events, be they natural or human-caused.
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, yes, it does. The agency has an emergency planning function, and part of what we look at is how the infrastructure would be maintained in case of an earthquake or a storm or any kind of disaster that would occur. The agency is responsible for the petroleum contingency plan. So if there are any petroleum issues, if there's a shortage of petroleum, we have a plan that goes into effect. I'll give you an example. During Hurricane Katrina, it actually affected Oregon because there was a dealer who refused to fuel up ambulances, even though they had a contract to fuel emergency vehicles in case, you know, there was a shortage of petroleum. And so we activated the plan, which allowed us to contact the dealer and said, no, you have a contract with emergency services to supply fuel, and you will do that. So, yes, there is. We have an emergency planning function, and that's part of what's in the plan.
Not to get too far afield, but who authorizes that? Is the director authorized to do that, or does it take an act of the governor in that situation? It's okay if
Mr.
you don't
Chair,
know.
I don't
I'm
know
just
the
curious
answer.
About that.
And Mr. Chairman, as a follow-up, and our Transmission infrastructure will be part of that evaluation as well.
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, yes, we work with the Public Utility Commission on the electricity infrastructure emergency planning.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Other questions, comments? Nobody wants to correct the new co-chair?
All right, leave it that way.
Thank you for your report, and we've got other issues we want to talk about, and we will get back to those. But we appreciate you coming forward with this report, and we've got one more. Hang with me here now, committee. We're in the home stretch here. The employment assessment of Oregon's renewable portfolio standard, and VJ, and I want to say Satyal,
you got it.
Is with us, and we are glad to see you.
Good afternoon, Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Representative Bailey, and all the members of the committee. My name is Vijay Satyal for the record, and I serve as a senior policy analyst with the Energy Policy Division of Oregon Department of Energy for the last 3 years. I'm here to provide an update on the Senate Bill 838-2007 Renewable Portfolio Standard, or Renewable Energy Standard, two names to it, bill that required ODO to evaluate the impact of the RPS legislation on employment levels in Oregon, with a little more specifics to the renewable energy sector, because the RPS was trying to jumpstart renewable energy generation in the state. Specifically, this job impact study, and the following lines I quote exactly verbatim from the legislation to prevent any miscommunication. Especially the job impact study sought to assess the number of new jobs created in the renewable energy sector in the state and the average wage rates and the provision of health care and other benefits in the renewable energy sector and related workforce training opportunities that are being provided to the employees to enter the renewable energy sector. The last part, to enter the renewable energy sector, I morphed because it was a kind of a long line, but that's the gist of the requirement or request to ODO. I'm going to just go through this in a couple of steps, if I may. ODO approach, or the efforts we took, specifically comprised of first trying to figure out what's around us. And an initial review basically made it pretty clear to ODO staff that there was a lack of comprehensive employment data or a system available to really understand what kind of employment opportunities can be measured that would comply or satisfy the specific requirements in the bill, as called out in the bill. Therefore, ODO staff explored a combination of various approaches. We started with a STAR extensive literature review that looked at other states. Two states really came up prominently, was Washington and Michigan, but we also looked at a combination of other studies that were inherent in the existing literature review, Pew Center and a couple of other studies. And we also then stepped ahead to realize that if we're not getting detailed renewable energy data, we could try to develop a survey. And ODO staff continued further to compile a survey and get it out to post-2007 RPS-eligible facilities in the state only. And in doing so, ODO designed a survey that had multiple set of questions asking for all the kind of questions that would relate to the main theme that I outlined earlier. And as through this process of compiling the survey and getting it out and doing reminder checks, ODO staff also researched estimates of employment levels that are often notified in the FSEC Energy Facility Siting Council certificates. These are the site certificates that are applied or posted with the FSEC Council when a large transmission project or a large renewable energy project will get sited if they're above certain thresholds that require an FSEC review. So in that site certificate, they ask for some detailed information. The challenges in undertaking the study that I would have to really get at would be the ODO staff experienced a range of challenges, and I will try to condense the two main themes. Similar to some other challenges that you heard actually on May 17th of this year when we had the Betsy study also brought up, and we had some similar challenges then. One is the employment measurement challenge, and the other would be the non-RPS factors that have being a driver to some of these big renewable energy projects, where RPS is not necessarily the key driver. The employment measurement challenges mainly consist of a lack of standard industry codes. The North American Industry Code Standards, NAICS, and the Standard Occupational Code, SOC, these two, yet even at the national level, there is there is an evaluation going on to understand how the renewable energy sector, in terms of the renewable energy generation systems, would be coded, so you can track specifically the jobs attributed to those sectors. Given the lack of that information, it was very hard to try to get data that would match up with that. The other issue was employment data sets that would call for pure renewable energy sector employment when you have often an overlap between, for lack of better words, an electrician in the morning fixing some systems in a restaurant, but in the evening installing solar panels. So you have a mixing of traditional and pure renewable energy specific employment in certain skill sets. So that also adds to the challenge of the reporting, therefore the collection, and therefore the measurement. The non-RPS factors basically include a range of state, county level. A lot of the counties in Oregon, as you all know, have tax credits, property tax incentives, other business incentive programs, loan benefit programs, the USDA loan guarantee programs, and other federal level incentives that, frankly, have tied in to bring in some of these projects into Oregon. And RPS was a factor, but not the main driving factor. So given these challenges, this effort led to the study in the best way possible, our first update report that I think is up on our website. And the conclusion comes to a survey that we would like to really justify and explain to that shows Oregon-eligible facilities located in Oregon only that began operation after January 2007 had very good responses specific only to the wind and biomass sectors, and the hydroelectric and solar systems were not able to respond to the survey, or they did not, or we can't force anyone to respond to the survey. And 82 permanent FTE were reported, or 82 full-time jobs only were reported from 9 electric generation facilities. And so we could safely say those 82 FTE were from the wind and biomass sector specifically. But even that is a conservative estimate in Odo staff's opinion. And additional jobs surely have been created through temporary contractual labor, the short-term assignments, and they're done and the project gets built. But going back to the employment measurement issue and the other factors, it has been hard to track or get that information. So this would be, in my opinion, staff's update on the 838 job impact study requirement that was requested by the legislature. I'm happy to answer any questions if you have. Or, Lisa's with me. I think she can answer any other questions if I may not have an answer for. But that is the crux of our update.
Representative Boone.
Thank you. Thank you, Vijay.
Thank you.
You hit on what I was going to ask you. And when we toured Solar World during the PENWAR meetings, one of the things that they said were that there were several contractors around the state who are licensed to assess and then build up, you know, the solar panel array on buildings. And so those contractors they might be in business doing other things too, contracting and, you know, building other stuff. But then when they're doing that, then they're providing jobs in that sector. So I guess the question is would they be double counted, you know, in that sense?
Go ahead.
That's a very good question. And actually that is the ultimate, if I can say, concern, fear. You want to come out conservative than overestimate. And I am sure other agencies, specifically Employment Department, who tries to attempt to track such information as well, deal with the same challenge. Yeah. That is, that has and always been the staff's main concern as we kept working through this. Therefore, the number we quoted to you was a permanent FTE only that we could safely feel was the result from the surveys.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Did you mention that this is online? Is that what you said? What the report that you've given? Or is it more extensive?
Yes, Co-Chair Representative Gilliam. And I apologize for not addressing
Bruno. She's very insulted, but it's okay.
It just hit me.
Yeah.
But yes, it is online as of August, late August. It's an August 2011 report. And it's always an interesting, it should number, be available for you.
Yeah, I appreciate your report and coming, and I appreciate the frustration if information is not available. You can appreciate my frustration when we're required to require you to give us a report. So it's kind of a extensive, accurate information. It's kind of a chicken or egg. How do we get at this? And I don't know that I know the answer, but it's a little frustrating, and I'm not trying to take that out on you, but there's not much information there. And I do take heart in the, there's a positive sort of direction from what you say, inadequate as the data may be, that there is activity. I think it's worth saying, maybe not repeating what everybody believes, but I think it's worth saying we're all, I'm sure everybody in this room, but I know everybody in this panel, is about jobs. So any positive information about jobs is good, but more specific information about investment we're making, focus that we have is important to us. We want to be going the right direction and being the kind of partners to industry in Oregon that actually creates jobs. And there's not much here, so I don't know where we go from here.
Well, maybe it's how you ask the question then when you query these businesses. And maybe you can ask them that question like they do in some of the surveys we give the school kids, you know, have you ever, you know, done work in this area, and then list, you know, the whatever they list, and then other, even if they're doing other things and they're already doing that type of work in that sector, maybe they're doing insulation, I'm just making this up, but if they're only doing insulation and finished carpentry or something, and then all of a sudden the client says, you know what, I want to put solar panels on, or I want to put a windmill on my house or whatever, so then they put that into the plan, and so they already are working in that sense. Maybe they hire a couple of extra people just for a week or two to install these other devices, and so that could count because it did provide some mm-hmm. work, and then we would know. You could drill it down to, is this a full-time job or is it a temporary job and stuff like that, because they do have to report that on their workers' comp claims, because, or not claims, but forms, so that they are paying certain fees
for another
whatever.
Possible source.
It's just some way maybe you could cross-reference it and find out, because it sounds like there are additional jobs in this, whether or not they're permanent FTEs or not, but it would be too bad to not count it if this person doesn't do it full-time and just does a little bit, and they're already in a position, so...
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Co-Chair, does your report call out the amount of money we've spent? In other words, call out the jobs created. We must have to say how much money we've spent attempting, invested is the way to put it. Does the report call that out?
Go ahead. You can respond.
I think this, it's a pertinent question, but this was purely an assessment of the number of jobs, if created, in the renewable energy sector, and where was RPS associated with it, if at all. So it was not an assessment of the fiscal side of the investments that have gone in to promote this, the different slew of measures that may have been attributed to RPS, if I may. That's my answer, Representative Benz.
Right. And follow up, Mr. Kosher.
Yeah.
Please, having sat in on some of the discussions with the group that was asked to do the analysis of the Betsy, I understand the complexity of the charge that was given you. I have a very general understanding of that complexity. What would be of greatest interest to me, of course, in looking at the RPS is A, how much money we've spent, B, how many jobs were created, and C, how many other benefits we have has Oregon enjoyed as a result of the RPS. It is a huge question, mm-hmm. but the place to start would be to say how much money we've spent, because that's real. And then we can put under that, whatever that humongous number is, we can say, okay, here are the benefits that we've achieved as a result of this investment. Number of jobs, unclear, clear air, I hope. Wouldn't have happened otherwise, drove a whole bunch of other investment, maybe. Those are the kind of, that's the kind of analysis that I think this group is probably best suited to hear. Not that I want to be detrimental, say anything detrimental about our group, but it's a complex area. I'd like to start with the amount invested is what I'm really saying.
Co-Chair Representative Benz, that's a very valid point. We'll think about how to answer some of those questions you've raised. I should bring in one a bit of clarity. Through House Bill 3680, the improvements that were done to the former Betsy program and the House Bill 3672 that's been passed that you just heard an update on, there is an effort being made to track and ask for basic employment information in ways that would help bring in information that has not been previously designed for the agency to collect. The hope would be, and which we can keep in mind, where is to combine or overlap some of those projects where if we get that information with, if they are RPS eligible and RPS compliant, then we'll get an additional source of information. So that's to one of your three questions, but we'll try to keep in mind the other two that you brought up.
And I assume,
and I appreciate it.
Go ahead. I assume that it's too early to tell how Cool Schools will factor into a report like this, but I'm looking forward to that and the results from that. And I guess my other question is, maybe you already alluded to this, does Brad Avakian's office, which is
labor,
the commissioner Boley, does Boley have some resources that have you coordinated with them for gleaning more info? I don't know.
I would like to say that we have. I apologize, Co-Chair. Representative Gilliam, I think we have been having a lot of internal staff conversations, a lot of interagency interaction to try to better understand and solve this 9.6% unemployment issue, to identify how other agencies have employment data that we could benefit from. There are two studies, there are two efforts. One is with the biomass sector that one of my colleagues has done a lot of effort to try to relate and understand where we can track biomass jobs. I would relate to future efforts through the, I understand the Green Jobs Council is working hard in this area, and there will be an effort to try to see where and how we can get more interaction. I have to politely say that it does boil down to the resources at hand, but we are definitely looking into where and how we can get more better information. Going back to the federal and national level codes that are yet being ironed out on what will be easily available through the unemployment insurance filings. There's a bit of a tie-in on what is reported and therefore what we can measure. But I totally get your message, and I'll keep that in mind.
Good. And from the discussion and the suggestions from the panel, you know, I urge you to take another look at this. You can share with us the way you are now at the one of our future meetings, or we'd be interested in the updated website if you'd bring that to our attention. But if you could explore some of these, we'd be interested in anything that would move us to a little more complete picture of what's happening.
Thank you, Co-Chair Bailey.
I think, Mr. Co-Chair, to reiterate the point, I think one thing that might be helpful as you do this is to use your work to give us a roadmap of where we might be able to identify information resources, data resources, how we can help make those kinds of things available to you by requiring them in other places or by requiring data streams. I think as you appropriately acknowledge, it's all about the data. And my understanding of the challenge, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that part of the issue is that you're looking for cross-sectoral data so that you don't have to go into everybody's pro forma and figure out exactly what happened, which you could do. I mean, that data is theoretically... I guess the issue is the data does exist. It's how far are you able to go to dig in to and get the data and to aggregate up and project off of it. And so giving us a better idea of where those challenges exactly are is going to help us in our construction of our requirements to you to get that information back, because it's information we do need.
Mr. Chair, if I could, because this has been an issue that the department has, we have a lot of angst over this because, and you've heard me say this, you've heard the department say this, and it's going to sound like a broken record, and I apologize for that, but historically speaking, it was not the mission of the Department of Energy to incent jobs. But under the under the conditions in which we're all living and with the unemployment rate as it, we understand and appreciate and share the concern. So we have, we're trying to pivot, to shift to a model in which that we can make sure that we have access either to the data that we're directly collecting or to what other agencies or entities are collecting. We're working very closely with department, with the Employment Department, working with them to hopefully get some the proper coding in place so that we can be sure that we're not counting a job that might be captured under what common term of the green economy, but that is very specific to renewable energy development so that we know what we're actually counting. In processing applications for tax credits or grants, we're asking for jobs information so that we can begin collecting that. And shameless plug, part of the problem is resources. You know, do we have the database capacity to manage, to store and manage and utilize and to utilize that data? Yeah, we could use a little bit of help there too. But we're working very hard. When I came on the agency almost a year and a half ago, one of my first questions of individuals like Vijay, in fact, probably directly to Vijay, was, where's the data? You know, because we need to have the data to provide to the legislature. That's one thing I knew. And it was shocking and somewhat disappointing, but we are working on it, and we want that more than anything.
Can I follow up on that?
If you'll just re-identify at the end of that comment.
I'm sorry. Lisa Pinero, Government Relations Manager.
Thanks. Just a quick follow-up to say, I agree with that. Speaking for myself personally, I want to make sure that we're not putting the cart before the horse in that I hear you say it's resources. I understand that it's difficult to get at that data. But I think, again, speaking for myself, I know I would feel comfortable allocating what's needed to get good jobs information so we can plan and grow jobs. But in order to feel comfortable for that, I need a very clear roadmap of where the data is going to come from, what the barriers are, why resources are going to address the issue, where the resources are going to go, how it's going to set up a pipeline for the future. And so it's really more about understanding those barriers and exactly how we can overcome them to get really good jobs information so we're not constantly asking for jobs and then getting a report back that says, well, we can't do it. I think we really need to understand that better. And if the answer is resources, which it might be, it might not be, there might be other ways to do it, understanding exactly that linkage, I think, is going to be necessary to making that case.
Point well taken. Point well taken.
Thank you both. And we'll move on. For this next subject, I'm going to rely on our colleague, Representative Boone, to sort of tee us up and introduce our presenter.
Yeah, Mr. Trumbull is my constituent, and he came to me a couple weeks ago and discussed his product and what he wants to do and what he likes to do. It's really asking a lot of him to compress it into such a short presentation, but I think it's good in the sense that he'll get a short presentation and have some time for questions from the panel, and I think you will have some questions, and it's a very interesting concept and what he's trying to do, and I asked, and I thank both co-chairs for allowing this at such a late date to get him on this panel, because he's moving forward quickly, and we wanted to ride that tide in surfer vernacular.
Thank you.
Catch that wave. But it has nothing to do with waves, so just so you know.
Thank you for that, and welcome, Mr.
Welcome.
Trumbull.
Well, thank you for having me. My name is Jonathan Trumbull, and I want to thank Representative Boone for getting me in here on such short notice, and all of you for seeing me. And I have tried to get this down to less than 8 minutes, so plenty of time.
You're amazing, then.
So I'm working on
a lot of information.
I'd like to start with a brief history of who the company is and our history in the region, actually. Is it up there yet? Oh, go ahead. Right, where was that? I'm still screen. Okay. Let's see. I'm the president of Eco Mineral and Steel Corporation, and in 1963, my father, partner, and Eco Mineral and Steel Corporation co-founder, Robert W. Trumbull, was the first and only person to ever have made high-quality steel. Not low-grade pig iron, which has very little value, but high-quality steel using the dredge spoils from the Columbia River Delta.
And I just interrupted you to say we're joined by, I believe, your senator. And,
Correct, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
We're glad you're here. We heard about losing Betsy. We're glad we haven't lost all the good Betsys. So go right ahead.
Okay. So my father did a demonstration, a 25-ton demonstration run for the then-sitting governor of Oregon, Mark Hatfield. He performed this at Jim Lovell's Astoria Foundry using his proprietary Trumbull process that he developed specifically for the titaniferous ore, which is what makes it needing a specific process compared to other ores. It's because the magnetite is bonded with TiO2, making it, at the time in history, anywhere in North America, impossible to use except for one other existing competing way of doing it. And that one was inferior because you could only produce pig iron with it. And at the time, pig iron sold so low that the energy consumed to process this magnetite sand ore was greater than you could sell the product for. And my father offered in his process to license it, and this was the Bunker Hill Corporation based in Hammond, but their plant is still there in between Bio-Oregon and the Hammond Fish Plant, and now covered in foliage now. But basically, that process didn't allow them to actually create high-quality steel, so they went out of business within 6 months and closed up shop. Now, my father's process worked. It impressed Governor Hatfield to the extent that he called over the Governor Rosellini from Washington and said, you got to see this guy do his process. And he went up to Washington to Isaacson Steelworks and actually ran a 250-ton run before him. At that time, this inspired Governor Rosellini to actually start a whole project, do a whole governor an analysis on the state of Washington on the ore in the river. Hired my father to go out and do core samples on the Oregon and Washington side, where he sampled what the mineral content was pretty much everywhere. And we have all that information still. And make a long story short. So, Governor, he invested. Rosellini got together a group of investors with my father. There's a long list of people that's not here. I'll be happy to provide everything for its interesting history on the region and the state. Even the Schnitzers were invested because they were involved in the Peacock-Spitz Association. Now, the only reason why they ended up building a steel mill and an ore production facility in Chinook, Washington, which still stands to this day. It's been gutted, but it still stands to this day, and we've partnered with the owner of the facility to run a ore enrichment plant, which, by the way, is a clean process, an ecologically friendly, clean process that uses no chemicals in a closed-loop system using only water as a medium. It mimics five natural forces, and that allows these molecules to separate. And it's done in a proprietary process that my father developed through his research. Now, unfortunately, the project fractured. And it fractured due to gold fever. There was trace amounts of gold discovered. It wasn't everywhere, but it was enough to get some of the key investors to not think about what was bulk there, the iron, but only see the gold. My father said, if you go after the gold, you'll go bankrupt in 3 months. Because the energy consumed, even today at today's gold price, the gold would still not bring enough money to warrant going after it. But they couldn't get over the gold fever. They gutted the rest of the plant, set up another facility, went out of business in 90 days with a $60,000 electric bill greater than they could pay the U.S. Mint, which they had contracted for. Now let's fast forward 47 years to the day. I think we should move a little quicker. To phase one of the Rice Island project. I say phase one because I didn't have enough time to prepare my phase two, which encompasses a lot more than just Rice Island. This is the stepping stone. And that is to reduce the impact of dredge spoils on the ports and provide a new industry and jobs. First, we'll offload from a low draft barge, portable biodiesel, electric powered processing equipment, earth moving and loading equipment. Then we will process on-site using the portable multi-stage separators and concentrators that mimic natural forces in a closed-loop system, and water as the only medium. This is a non-toxic, low-impact operation. We plan to produce 50,000 tons of magnetite every 30 to 45 days, as that is what customers in Korea, customers in China, Japan expect because sometimes they will build mills directly to your chemistry, and they expect you to provide a certain amount per month. Now, there's more than enough there to provide that for the next 10 years and on and on and on without even getting into what is below. That's just the 11 million tons on the uplands we can remove, 11 million cubic yards. So the other trace minerals are bagged. We leave no waste. We have approximately 21% left of pure white silica sand that could be used to Siesta Key in Florida. It has a marketable value, as great if not greater than iron. And in fact, I've found a local plant, a bottling plant, that makes wine bottles, and they've been struggling to compete with a Chinese factory. They consider it their sister factory, whether they're undercutting them, making cheaper bottles, and they can get the. And the problem is they can't get sand quick enough. They can't get sand in a steady enough flow, and they're having to move all the way from a similar problem as this that's been going on for decades, run by Nippon Steel in Japan, in Canada, on the Mackenzie River. And they've been getting the sand there, and they are not happy with dealing with that. There's too much back and forth, and it's too long of a distance for the sand to travel. So I have a local, I really have all the waste product already sold. They say they want to start in May. They're redoing their facility, and they can take 960 tons of pure white sand per week for the next 10 years. They'd like their commitment to that. It tends to be that for some reason they like 10 years, most of these plants. They want to, before they invest in something or someone or set up a relationship or the money and expense of setting up a business relationship, they want to see that you can provide for 5 to 10 years, 10 preferably. So once processed, the ore will be loaded onto a barge using a 190-foot extendable portable telestacker. And this thing will not touch the beachfront. It can stand up on the uplands and shoot it right onto the barge. The only thing sitting on the beach is two dolphin fins that come down for the equipment to come on and off again. So we're not operating directly on the beachhead. And we only plan to cut the uplands, the 11,000 cubic yards that sit above the beachhead, above what they call the uplands. So of the estimated 45 million cubic yards that have been accumulated at this site since 1962, there's approximately 11 million cubic yards that need to be removed to allow for more dredge spoils, which eliminates the money being spent and the research being spent on where do we put future spoil sites. Why don't we use the ones we have already? Turn it into a commodity, producing tax revenue, in addition to the millions of dollars that will go to the Oregon State schools from all the royalties. Every time I take a scoop of sand from that island, I'm paying the state 80 cents per cubic yard. And if I have a five-yard Michigan loader. So every time I take a scoop, I'm putting dollars into the school system. Now, where do we stand to make this a realistic option? Because we learned back in 2005 with the Peter Guerin situation that you really have to make sure you can actually sell the product before you have a plan. So I have Korean, Japanese, and Chinese mills that want all the iron. Japanese, Russian, and U.S.-based mills right now lined up ready for the titanium, which is the ilmenite. And the key is you got to be able to separate the ilmenite from control the chemistry. It's something that we can do that other people can't do through my father's process in 63. I found that we can control the chemistry, control exactly. If you want this much percentage of titanium, I can get you this much percentage of titanium. If you want this much silica, I can make it this much silica. That's something other people don't do. We have signed a 10-year exclusive lease to process on-site at the Port of Owako all of their material. That gives us 1 to 3 years of operating. Not enough to secure our current investors' waiting interest. Enough to get them to the point where they said, we want to invest, let's see what happens on September 29th at Rice Island. The largest domestic broker of surplus goods and metals to China, GBD International, is offering to provide all the necessary capital to invest in this project to get us going, all the equipment. The U.S.-based buyer for Nippon Steel and POSCO Steel, and interesting because the Port of Astoria is claiming to have a relationship with POSCO. They have a relationship with a third party who is not POSCO and still has yet to be able to set up an arrangement with POSCO. I have set up an arrangement with the buyer of Nippon Steel because POSCO is really a subsidiary of Nippon Steel. They started POSCO Steel. They provided all their technology and infrastructure, and POSCO buys materials through Nippon Steel, as it turns out. So I don't know what they're going to do with the third-party broker. It's really not POSCO. And POSCO Steel is interested in a long-term contract depending on the state land board decision on the 29th between the Port of Astoria, which has with no viable product to market because the sand is worthless as it sits. It's worth what I'll pay, what I pay the state, 80 cents per cubic yard, 40 cents per ton. It costs $10 to $20 per ton minimum every time you move it from point A to point B. That's a net loss to the taxpayer, a large net loss. So we have a viable product and all the processes needed to bring the greatest potential benefit to the people of Oregon and the whole of the region with this great resource. The picture here to the left is right off of my iPhone from our highest grade ever created. And it technically it's the highest grade ever created on the world market. And it will set a new industry standard in the world. Eco Minerals' highest grade processed magnetite iron sand fines is 73% Fe iron. The highest grade before this was 67. 67 was marketed by Australia. It has shut down because the EPA shut it down. Unlike the Columbia River resource, Australian resource is finite. This is renewing at a rate of over 5 million cubic yards every single year due to the intensity of our river against the basaltic volcanic flows where the iron comes from. Simply erosion. We are eroding over 5 million cubic tons a year on the basaltic walls of the rivers, and it's also coming through all the river systems. In addition, you have underground geologic activity happening. All of this is contributing to the increase in minerals in the sand and the increase in sediments to the point where local authorities on the ports are getting buried in sediments. And over in Baker Bay, Washington, they say that in 1 to 2 years, earmarks, that $13 million earmark that's shared by both Oregon and Washington for dredging will probably, in their view, as when they talk to the Army Corps of Engineers, be gone next year. And it'll be up to the local communities to dig themselves out of sand. I propose to solve that problem. Get me going as soon as possible, making as much money as possible, and I will dredge it at cost. I have designed a dredge system that can reduce duplication of efforts and dredge it and process it all in the same time. And then in the end, it just comes out as the end product. And yes, a ship could come up midstream and just transfer it right over to the ship and take it to the customer. There will be customers domestically, so this could be trucking services are going to benefit. I'm already discussing contracts with Lindstrom in Washington, and I'm looking at Big River in Oregon, in Clatsop County. All people who have hurt badly by the decline in the construction industry and need work. On to the next thing. A little comparison of the benefits on the plants, the region, and the state. The Eco Mineral Plan will mitigate existing dredge spoils, allowing ports to deposit new spoils, create family wage jobs in the community, and is an ecologically sound and economically fruitful use of what has been considered waste and spoils up until this point. This will produce millions of dollars every year for schools in the royalty fees, in addition to conservatively, we estimated based on our first business plan that we would produce $7 million in state taxes by the third year alone. And increasing by the fifth year, we'd be to about $12 million. And that's not based on a long-term contract with Korea or POSCO. If we get POSCO or China in a long-term contract where we're providing a set amount per month, it would be even higher than that. Because this was based on doing small, producing 6 months of the year and not all year and only about 50,000 tons 6 months of the year that we could do this on. Helping a local Oregon-based startup, most importantly, with the raw material it needs to start a new local industry, providing much-needed positive trade balance with Asia. It'd be nice to have an industry that actually has a positive trade balance with Asia instead of a negative one. And in fact, recently, Steel Business Briefing magazine did a review on an event that happened sponsored by Obama, where he said that the number one thing in America has to offer to bring American exports back is the steel and particularly the iron ore industry because we have the raw materials. And the advantage we have here over the rest of America is we have a direct access to world markets. They have to rail it, they have to ship it through river systems, they have to truck it to get it to a port because all the other sources are inland. So this is the most strategically competitive source available in North America aside from the Mackenzie in Canada, which has been used in this manner through a subcontract with Nippon Steel for the past 20 years. So let me compare that with the Port of Astoria plan. There are no customers that are interested in unprocessed dredge spoils, period, explanation point. Without a customer, there will be no royalty fees to the state for schools. As a government agency, the port will not pay taxes that benefit the community and the state as a whole. Like the Peter Goering plan before it, the port's plan will fail before it even begins. Without a desirable finished commodity like the eco-mineral plan will create. And in summary, to the distinguished members of this committee, I respectfully ask you all to go online to the State Board of Lands website for Clatsop County sand gravel permits, and please review both plans carefully. Please be sure to make comments about the merits or lack thereof regarding each plan, and of course, please show your support for local small business entrepreneurs like myself by endorsing the eco-mineral plan for Rice Island. I thank you all for your time and consideration on this matter, and a special thanks goes to Senator Betsy Johnson for some great advice she gave me and her support. Thank you.
Thank you for that.
And I have actually very provided the plans for you all.
Okay, good. Is it safe to say that the port plan really is just a traditional dredging plan? I mean, that's the way they've always...
They did not have a plan. Mm-hmm. The port came to me and asked me to finish their plan. They had come to me and asked for a joint venture. They said, why are you going up for private capital when you can joint venture with us? And I said, well, great. Let's sign some joint venture papers. So can we see your business plan? We have some people coming out of town, and we want to see if this is really something we want to show them. Okay, if you sign a confidentiality agreement, non-competition agreement, which Mr. Kreider signed. Then they proceeded to ask, well, we need you to help you prepare a multimedia presentation for them and show an operating plan. I said, okay, we'll work on that. But then I realized past history with the port and past conversations I had with Jack, I was a little leery. Even though that paper was signed, I was still leery. And it turns out, rightfully so. So they didn't have a plan because they asked me to make their plan. And the day that he asked me to make the plan was when I was sitting at the table with Sonny Park, who was their version of POSCO. And I said to Jack, I said, this is great. Okay, let's do this. Let's send this sample, let's send it off to your Korean counterparts, and let's see what happens. But if you want me to prepare your operating plan, I need you to name me on it, because I'm not going to do all the brain work, do all the work, and then not even have my name on the plan, and my investor would laugh at me. So what do you say to that, Jack? Are you ready to do that? And he said, well, not at this time. We can't do that. So I said, okay, well, I'll see you next week. We'll talk about it when we meet with the Korean contingent. And in between that week, that next Monday, I called the state and asked them myself, what's going on? Because he just said that they just applied and that Peter Goering had a lease and I couldn't get in there. What are we doing here? And can we apply? Because according to the port, it was all closed. Nobody else could apply. So she said, oh, absolutely not true. We can all apply. So basically, within a week, I filed my plan. It was deemed complete in a few weeks later. The plan was deemed complete a few weeks later. And the port was given 2 weeks' notice to come up with a plan. And in the last final hour, they cut and pasted some stuff from a few websites and some stuff from the Oregon Solutions Group and came up with their plan, which was the same plan Peter Goering had. Only difference changed the customer.
In the interest of time, yes. We're going to probably need to... adjourn, yeah. But we appreciate this, and yes. I take one of the next steps is for us to go to the website ourselves.
Yeah, and I have provided
we can
plans.
Do that, and I'll look forward to an update, particularly from our committee member, as this progresses. And
yes.
Thank you very much. If there's
thank
no
you.
Other comments or questions,
anyone have any questions?
Wait a minute, we may have one. Yes, Representative
please.
Witt.
Do we have time, Mr. Chairman?
Sure.
Thank
for you.
Yes. Thank you for that indulgence. As the plumbers say, nasty stuff flows downhill.
Yes.
That part of the Columbia River is a catch basin for all the nasties that flow into the river upriver. Are you familiar with the fact that the Port of Astoria was fined because they had dredge spoils that were improperly stored and leached back into the Columbia River and were found to have contaminated the Columbia River with the very material that they pulled out of that.
The point I'm trying to make is there are some nasties in that stuff, and I am curious whether your process will concentrate those nasties and how you plan to deal with those toxic materials that are in those dredge spoils.
Well, from what I understand, there has been tests done recently on the dredge spoils that are on Rice Island in the last 5 years ago. I checked with this question with Jim Grimes, the Bureau of Land Management, and Louise Soliday, and they both assured me that they had all tested clean, and they had been deemed clean by the EPA. There are sites and spots where it collects, and the port does have certain spots. It's not Sand Island. It's not Rice Island. They have been tested and deemed, and I actually won't even start in Oahu. I wrote it into, because I spent 10 years as an environmental activist before I did this. So I'm not interested in polluting at all. I'm interested in solving a problem and seeing my father's good technology go to good use. But number one, the State Bureau of Land's position is that those sands are clean. And that is and they say that is the position of the EPA on that.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to be a show me. The Port of Astoria is directly downstream from the islands that we're discussing. So maybe it's clean up river, not down.
The Port of Astoria has other sites that they have illegally dumped on. Yes. They even told me that. They asked me, we have lots of sites and we get fined every year by the EPA for illegally dumping. Can you do anything with those sites? I said, down the road, yes, there is a method of doing it. There are green systems that you can combine together to trap, collect, or clean toxic waste, which is Jim Grimes asked me if I'd be interested in taking on the challenge at the Willamette River. I said, yeah, maybe after 5 years of accumulating enough resources, I'd take that spot on where the Willamette meets the Columbia. Because that's very toxic. That's actually the most toxic. That's where the most toxins, according to them, are accumulated, and they're having a problem. They're not allowed to move the dredge spoils, and it's becoming impassable. They need to dredge it. They need a solution. So part of actually, there's another page in here where I have a paragraph where Jim Grimes asked me that question, and I responded to him that, well, we are interested in that, and I believe that there are existing technologies that could be combined. With redredging the material, you could process it at the same time and clean the water as you're doing it. But once again, that's not even the responsibility of the one dredging to clean all the water, but it could be done. But that would be a combined effort with other industries, other businesses that produce these machines, which some of them were talked about quite recently in the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico.
Well, thank you again for your time. Representative, your point is well taken,
And I thought heavily about that point.
Having just taken a Superfunds tour up the Willamette, your concern is well-founded, and I appreciate the question. We're going to move to one last piece of business about the possibility that we can discuss you have the draft in front of you, and again, Representative Boone, you want to say a word about this?
Yeah, you have before you a draft. This language comes from the state of Alaska. I would like to entertain the committee's indulgence in considering this a resolution that would mirror this as a committee submitted bill in 2012. And we all have constituents in the Coast Guard, and we all have likely constituents who work in Alaska waters. And this really calls to, if you read through it, a support for reauthorization of re-equipping Coast Guard Station Kodiak, which is the largest in the U.S. And they have been being pecked away at, and they have just lost another C-130 transport plane, which is their main piece of equipment that they use to go out on these rescue calls and drug interdiction calls, et cetera, all their mission. They have 11 missions. So I was up there with the Pacific Fisheries Legislative Task Force, and we toured the Coast Guard station. We actually were touring it when they had a call, and one of their three left helos that they have left was getting outfitted and ready to go out on a call to pick up a burn victim off a ship. And they were having the ship come toward them as fast as possible, but it was still a four-hour flight one way. And in the end, an hour and a half later, they were canceled because it was taking so long. And we can only surmise they were canceled because the gentleman died, and they didn't need it anymore. So my point take is, if you read through this, you'll see, I know it's a lot of more words and stuff. You've got some time, got a couple more meetings to do this. I'm having it drafted now. My point is the Alaska Kodiak Station has the largest region to cover with the least amount of equipment anymore, and what they're used to having. If the call is out on the Aleutian chain, thanks, Jonathan, and they're in Kodiak, that's a long haul out there by either the C-130 or the helicopter. In addition to that, we are opening up the Arctic for various reasons. They're going to see a lot more fishing there, a lot of shipping. We're talking about a deep water port in Barrow, and Kodiak will be the station. So my point is, if we can all, the task force was asked if each of the five states would present a resolution. You'll see this resolution is from the task force. We just, in the interest of time, took their language, and we'll be using that. So I would like for this committee to, as a committee bill, submit this resolution to the 2012 session as a resolution in support of re-equipping this Coast Guard station that we all benefit from. And the task force initially will also be doing their own type of resolution, although it's not a legislative resolution. So all five states have agreed, or all four states other than, I'm asking Oregon to do it. I will be submitting this for Oregon. So all five states will be submitting a resolution to Congress and the President, and hopefully get the reauthorization and the funding for this. So,
comment on that, Representative.
Do resolutions count against our five committee bills?
I had the same thought.
Mm-hmm. I don't know.
I think they do.
You do?
And is it the case that the committee can only ask for five drafts, but
yes,
that we can do? Can we introduce as committee bills drafts that have been requested as member requested drafts that don't count against the five?
That is a good question. I think five is your limit, but I can double check on that and find out if others have requested it. If you can go over the five, I'll have to double check.
I was told yesterday that a draft on my part counts against my two bills.
Mm-hmm.
So I would assume that if we have this drafted, it'll count against our foot five.
The committee.
Yeah, if the committee asks.
Yeah, you already asked.
I guess what I'm curious is, for example, with your committee, if you, as an individual member, requested a draft that then counted against your two.
If I go down and say I'd like you to draft this concept into a bill for me, whether or not I intend to move it in the future, it counts against the two.
And if that draft counted against your two is then handed to the committee to be introduced as a committee bill, would it count against the five?
Right.
You're going to check on
that. Yeah, I haven't submitted for a draft under my name. I've given a preempt. I've sent this down to them to ready and waiting in case this committee will agree to do that.
Okay.
If in that scenario it doesn't count against the committee bills, I think all of us, except for you, are in agreement then to have it counted against your bills.
Yes. So moved.
Everybody okay with Alex? Thank you for your patience, committee. And with that, I will adjourn the House Interim Committee on Energy, Environment, and Water.